currency. If you were at war with a nation, how would you use it against another nation?
You could produce a nanobot that would destroy a very specific type of material. Perhaps it would look for explosives and break them down into inert components so that someone's guns wouldn't fire.
Oh.
So you could do something as targeted as that, as simple as that. And so when you think about a smart bomb, this is in fact the ultimate sort of tininess of a smart bomb, in that it can go in and defuse a bomb. Or you could take another type of nanobot and have it replicate so that it produced an explosive out of an inert material. You could perhaps transform a clay surface into an explosive surface.
What if you wanted to kill only Iraqi people?
Then you'd probably have to look at something that was very specifically targeted at the genome of a particular class of people. That sounds to me like it would be a little bit more difficult to do. Or, conceivably, you could distribute a widespread weapon, but only distribute the antidote to your own side. But there are a lot of dangers in that.
You mean to the one doing the dispersing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's any time you release something into the environment, there's obviously the chance that it could mutate.
Mm. But, I mean, the military is going to be in love with this technology.
They already are. They're funding it.
Uh-huh. They are, huh?
Oh, yes. Yes, the funding is coming from the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the same agency that gave us the Internet 30 years ago, and from the federal government and also from universities. So you have places like MIT, University of Michigan, University of California, Los Angeles, places like this that are really becoming hotbeds of nanotechnology research and that are really going to be the focal centers for the nanotechnology revolution.
If you were a scientist working in that area, when the U.S. military came to you, you can imagine what their interests would be. Would you accept that funding to keep doing what you want to do?
I personally would not. I personally would want to focus on the positive applications of nanotechnology, that nanotechnology would quickly be capable of wiping out any disease or any sort of malnutrition, that you could take garbage materials, literally throw some nanites or bugs onto the top of this and then convert it into edible food.
Yes, or conversely, wiping out the human race.
Exactly. And so I would want to, as far as I could, work on the positive aspects of it. And I think that's one reason why the ethical dimension of this technology needs to be examined closely, because it promises so much and threatens so much. They're really, in a sense, a perfectly equal balance.
Senator Bell again asks, what precise regulation would you recommend to this committee?
Well, I think the nanotechnology research needs to be conducted on the same kinds of safeguards that we would do very sort of dangerous biological research, that we need to develop the kinds of facilities that can prevent things from getting into the environment accidentally, or otherwise you're going to have an Andromeda strain scenario where something is created that can't be contained or controlled and will destroy any population it encounters.
So then the equivalent of the CDC should be formed.
Yeah, yes, or it may in fact be a branch of the CDC, because it, again, when you get down to this level, the differences between biology and nanotechnology start become very indistinct. They start to blur.
One would imagine many countries about the world would be hard at work at this right now. The Japanese, for example, they're really good in these sorts of areas. They would be, I would think, involved, are they?
The Japanese just produced a single electron, a single atom transistor.
Well, there you are.
So the Japanese are right alongside with the Americans and the Britons. The British are also right alongside with the Americans in this field, and we're really the three powers, with America by far being in the lead with the most researchers working on this. Now, one of the most interesting things that's being done long-term, one of the longest projects that's been going on, has been NASA's project to use nanotechnology for space exploration. The reason being that right now, spacecraft are very large, and when they're very large, it means it costs a lot of money to put them into orbit to send them to another planet.
Sure does.
And when you only have one of them, if it happens to crash, you're out of luck.
That's true.
So instead, why don't you produce 50 or 100 million small craft, deliver them in a small missile, release them, say, onto the surface of Mars, let them gather their data and send it back. And so this is now a very efficient way of doing it, because even if you lose half the spacecraft, you still have 50 million spacecraft.
Well, then, wait a minute here, Mark. If you're talking about Mars and releasing something on Mars, then why not release some form of the gray goo scenario on Mars? And why, before you know it, you'll have yourself a habitable planet, hello there, with an atmosphere and water and growing stuff and maybe even little furry things running around.
It's been talked about. We don't know how to do something like that yet, but clearly when we, as we grow into a fully realized nanotechnology, something like that will become more and more within the realm of possibility, and perhaps in another generation or two, there will be the moral equivalent of an Apollo project to green Mars.
Wow. This is amazing. Let's come back to reality, today's reality for a moment. Video games. Sony's new PlayStation 2.
Yeah.
And I guess Microsoft's Xbox?
Yes, that's what it's called. It's going to be released in October.
They have made such a jump. Do they begin to blur the line between reality and simulation?
Well, back when people were first working in virtual reality, so in the late 80s, early 90s, it was believed that you could create realistic images if you could create about 80 million little units that your eyes can see per second. If you could create these 80 million units, they figured it would be pretty much indistinguishable from the real thing. Well, with the PlayStation 2 and with the Xbox, we've gotten to that point. And if you've seen some of the things that have come out, some of the NFL games, some of the racing games, quite often when you look at them, you have to do a double take because you can't quite tell if that's a video image or if that's a computer-generated image. So we're now starting to enter this area of blurriness, whether we can tell if it's a computer-generated image or if it's, in fact, a live image of some sort.
So what are we liable to have by the time we get to Sony PlayStation 10 or 20? It's another way of asking, where is that going?
Well, right now, computer graphics and the kind that we use to say home video games are increasing not as fast as Moore's Law. They're not getting twice as good every 18 months. They're getting 8 times as good.
Really?
Every 18 months. It's Moore's Law cubed. So between 1995 and 2000, computer graphics got 1,000 times better. Between 2000 and 2005, everyone expects that they will get 1,000 times better again. So you don't have to wait for the PlayStation 10. You have to wait for the PlayStation 3, which Sony has already announced will be 1,000 times faster.
Oh, my God.
Than the PlayStation 2.
Really? Oh, my.
At that point,
yes,
there really won't be any strict difference between live video and a computer-generated image, at least none that your eye can easily see. I've seen a prototype for the PlayStation 3, something called the GS Cube, which is still itself only about a 1/16th as powerful as the PlayStation 3 will be. And it was just absolutely stunning. The images were so clear, so beautiful, so crisp, and so realistic that you can clearly see that by the time 2005 comes around, we will be there. We will be at this blurring between real imagery and computer-generated imagery.
Well, how far of a leap is it from PlayStation 3 or 4 to the holodeck on Star Trek?
The holodeck is really just a matter of how do we project it. Right now, that's been a big problem. We have television sets, we have monitors, we have flat panel displays.
Right.
But we don't have an environment we can stand up and walk around in.
Yet.
We had the head-mounted display, which everyone was looking at 10 years ago as being the way we'd get into the holodeck. Well, it turns out the head-mounted display is really bad for your eyes, which is why we're not all wearing them now. And so,
yeah, I've seen them advertised, and I've been tempted, and I don't know why I haven't gone for one, but it's not so good for your eyes, huh?
It'll give you, at the minimum, it'll give you a headache. It'll give you eye strain. In the worst case, it'll cause something called binocular dysphoria. Because what happens is when you put the head mount on, your eyes are seeing the world in a different way than you see it in the real world. And your brain learns that way, so that when you take the head mount off again, your brain is still thinking in the way it was when you were in the head-mounted display.
Uh-huh.
And this is not such a big problem for adults. Adults will come back anywhere between 20 minutes and 24 hours. But for children, and these video game companies were going to release these and sell them to children, could actually cause perhaps permanent changes in brain function.
In other words, their little brains, which are just in the formative stages, would or could perhaps take that as the reality, and then the real world would be the non-reality for them.
Exactly, and they would have trouble moving through the real world because their brains had adapted to something that wasn't real. Now, in the mid-1990s, I participated in a project with Sega, the video game company,
yes,
developing a head-mounted display, and we got it all the way through the design process and ready for production, and they sent it out for testing.
Right.
And when they sent it out for testing, the testing company came back and said, you cannot give these devices to children. Well, Sega said, thank you very much. We're going to take the results. We're going to take the project. We're going to bury it. The company that actually did the testing, SRI, went and retested on their own dime so they could release the results to the public because the results were important enough that they needed to be widely known. So head-mounted display use is fine for, say, 20 minutes or less. It won't really hurt you, although I wouldn't give it to a child for that length of time. But in terms of this holodeck world where we'd be sitting inside of our head-mounted display and the world would be projected around us, that doesn't seem to be a good way to do it. Now, there's just some breaking technology of people who are starting to do holographic projection inside of 3D globes.
Inside 3D globes?
So you can think of a clear glass globe.
Yes.
And they can project a 3D environment inside of it. You look into it almost as if you're looking into a crystal ball. And you can see a world inside of that. That technology has just entered the prototype stage. They've just gotten it working. But that may be one way of having a holodeck. Now, clearly, you're not inside that environment, but you can see into it, and it's fully 3D. You don't need to wear any fancy glasses. It's just there in front of you, and that may be one direction it's going in.
Suppose we made it all the way to holodeck, where you create a complete new reality all about you. You don't have the glasses on. It's all about you in 3D.
Right.
That presumably will be possible one day, right?
I would suggest that a better way to do that, rather than using a projection technology, is to use nanotechnology. Remember what I said earlier
To actually create that world.
Create the objects themselves out of material. I think that's going to be the cheaper, safer, more satisfying route for people, is to have a holodeck that it doesn't use objects made out of light.
Well, but the problem with that is you are then literally creating an alternate reality, because it is a reality. And so... but we're almost up to the Matrix here, in a way.
Absolutely. I think there's going to be a point 20 years from now or so when the difference between the synthetic world and the physical world is going to have blurred completely. Now, for the kids who are growing up with these kinds of video games, they're not going to have an issue with it. They've been used to it all of their lives. For us, it's going to be a little bit more disorienting because we're never going to know what really real is. Going to make a difference for
wouldn't that be fatally dangerous for mankind, in the sense that people would be able to create their own realities, and in every sense of the word, reality, an alternate reality, and to hell with this world in every way, just why not live in this idyllic created reality?
It would be a fatal flaw if it cut us off from other human beings. Otherwise, it wouldn't be qualitatively different than the worlds we see showing up in cyberspace, the chat environments, the websites, the webs of connectivity by which humans create their own mental spaces and gather and congregate. It would simply be a physical manifestation of it.
I know, but I mean, people would be creating Britney Spears land, right?
Indeed they would.
Well, how do you stop a human being from preferring that over the real world? Hold that answer. We'll be right back. Weird Stuff. I'm Artel.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. The girls will hold in my arms and know the magic of her charm, because I won't. Girl, to call my own, I want to dream of her, so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love, oh, so true, and the hand that
girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to be alone.
Wanna take a ride? Well, call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The Wild Card line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
I mean, why not? If it's nanotechnology, and we'll ask about this in a moment, why not? Shouldn't that alternate reality contain your dream lover? And then, is that your real mate, or is that your fantasy mate? Well, Kevin in Yarmouth, Maine, way up in Maine, says it a little more bluntly than I would have. He says, will nanotech be the future drug abuse? I want a Raquel Welch nano doll. You think internet porno is bad now? Just wait till nano porno comes along. Mark, is there any reason to believe that an alternate reality that you could eventually create with nanotechnology couldn't contain your mate?
Well, there's no fundamental reason to believe that. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the promises, if you could call it that, of nanotechnology is that it's going to blur the line for most people between the fantasy world and the real world, that that line isn't going to be as firm, as fixed, as neatly constructed as we are familiar with in the early 21st century.
So we may really look back on these as the good old days.
Or as the real old days.
Real old days, yeah, that's right. Oh, man. It's hard to imagine the kind of world you're talking about, and yet you're not the only expert, Mark, who said the things you're saying. You're articulating them, I think, a little more clearly and directly for me. Thank you for that, by the way. But there have been many experts who have said the same things you're saying. And I don't know. I don't know if it's a kind of world that I could accept. How about you?
Well, I think it's going to be for us, for the folks who grew up in the static world, the old world almost.
The old world. There you go.
It's going to be a little bit disorienting for us. It's almost as if you think about how people adopt technology. Younger people always use an ATM. Older people tend to go to see the teller.
That's right.
So it's almost like that. We may want this corner of our lives to have the kinds of benefits of nanotechnology. For example, life extension technologies will clearly be taking full advantage of that sort of thing.
Yeah, but what about his comment from Maine about the equivalent of drug abuse?
Well, I think that there's a more direct equivalent of drug abuse, which is that we could probably engineer nanosites that would directly stimulate centers of the brain. So you're not even talking about formulating a Raquel Welch doll. You're talking about generating what you would think of as probably a super heroine and be able to tie someone into that. And so there's a potential for abuse there. That's also enormous. And the question is whether these technologies will exist only in the pharmacological laboratories or whether they'll be relatively widespread. Every indication is that nanotechnology doesn't really require an expensive, huge environment to create. The basic tools of nanotechnology are relatively inexpensive. Less expensive than, say, a gene splicing laboratory. And as the techniques are discovered, those are going to be the things that will allow someone to do nanotechnology, say, in their den.
Do you think that the present state of social evolution in the world would support that technology being available right now, or would it, in essence, destroy the human race? If we had all that ability right now, we'd probably do ourselves in, wouldn't we?
I think we'd have to be very careful. I think we'd get wise very quick.
Well, or get gone.
Or get gone very quick.
So in other words, I guess I want to ask this. Is social development, in your opinion, moving in parallel with nanotechnological development?
I think for our children it definitely is. Our children are used to all of this blurriness, all of this in-betweenness between animate and inanimate, between static and active, between real and virtual. These are a matter of course for them. They really won't have the same sort of philosophical issues that we as grown-ups have. Now, whether that's going to be the thing that guides them safely into a nanotechnological era is anyone's guess. I think the most important thing we can do with our children is to educate them about the responsibilities that are inherent in any technology. Trouble we have with guns today.
Yes, do you think, for example, that a child of the future, say the next generation, because you're talking about 20 or 30 years or 40 years, not that long, that child will be able to easily make a decision about whether to turn little conscious Freddy off, and that it's not killing, and that the child will have come to grips with the fact that even though this is a conscious entity capable of emotions and feeling and learning and all those things, that that child will be able to just flip the switch, understanding that it's somehow different?
Well, it's interesting because the Furby itself does not have an off switch. One of the most interesting things about a Furby, one of the things that tends to drive adults crazy about it, is that there is no switch. You can take the batteries out if you want,
right,
but otherwise the Furby itself has to go to sleep on its own.
Right.
You basically have to give it a timeout, and then it will snore and go to sleep. So in that sense, these kids are already being prepared philosophically, psychologically, for objects that have their own intent, that you wouldn't turn Billy off. You might stop playing with Billy. He might whine about it a little bit, and then he'll go to sleep.
But if you didn't want Billy anymore at all?
Then you're talking about a different kind of problem. You're absolutely right. You're talking about what a child does when he doesn't want a pet anymore. It's that kind of emotional issue.
We can already see what happens in some cases when children decide they don't want their schoolmates anymore.
Right, exactly.
I mean, things are changing, and pretty fast, too.
Exactly. I mean, we have to take a look at our society's reaction to violence and the kinds of tools we use to create violence, whether they're guns or anything else. Right. We have to say, okay, if we know that a child can walk in with a gun and, God forbid, kill several people, well, what can they do if they can cook something up in their living room and wipe out a city? That's the world of the mid-21st century.
Uh-huh. That's going to be some world, isn't it, Mark? And it's so close.
It's close, and it's a beautiful place because of the powers that we gain. They're almost godlike powers that we gain.
Godlike, yes, I was going to say that. Godlike, creation.
Creation, almost. But at the same time, we have the same destructive powers that you would associate with a very sort of Old Testament God. And unless we can temper that with our humanity, with our desire to continue, not just individually, but as a species, you're absolutely right. We can't make it through a transition like that.
This discovery could then be more potentially dangerous to humankind than the splitting of the atom was.
Oh, it's been my firm belief that this is absolutely the case. The thing about the atom bomb is that it's very difficult to gather the materials necessary to make one.
And in the case of nanotechnology?
Everything's lying around. It's just a matter of putting it into the correct organization. And that's what we're learning.
Well, how many different centers and places right now around the U.S., around the world, are in serious development in these areas? I mean, how widespread is the technological research?
In America, certainly any major material science program at a major American university has some unit that's looking into nanotechnology. So you think about the major research centers, Harvard, MIT, University of California, University of Michigan, University of North Carolina. All of these centers have programs that are looking into these issues right now. But in addition, you also see the high-tech firms, IBM, for example. One of the things that IBM did back in 1981 was create something called the scanning tunneling microscope. The scanning tunneling microscope is very simple. It's really nothing more than a very, very sharp pin with a weak electrical charge on it. But it turns out that with that pin, you can move individual atoms around. Now, the fellows who invented this in 81 won the Nobel Prize just 5 years later for their work, because their work was so significant, because it allowed us to start pushing atoms around, and it's now become, in a sense, the basic building block for all nanotechnology applications, because we now have a finger that we can poke into the atomic world. And so you have research centers like IBM, like Hewlett-Packard, like Intel, and they need nanotechnology in order to stay ahead of the curve, in order to be able to provide us the next level of chips that we're going to need for the computers that we're going to need to do the things we're going to need in the world.
Well, your website is called Playful World. Obviously, you're an optimist about the technology for the most part.
Well, I believe that the most important thing is to make people aware and to educate them about the possibilities, both the upside and the downside. I'm very straightforward about talking about gray goo. Most of the nanotechnology community tries to downplay that scenario.
Do they talk about these researchers, Mark, talk about the gray goo scenario a lot privately?
Privately, they'll talk about it. Publicly, they don't want to alarm the public. They don't want to alarm the public to the degree that will scare them from looking at this research, because everyone's fairly convinced of its inevitability. And so what they want to do is to keep the public informed. So they phrase it differently. They talk about different kinds of problems. One is called the toner war, where you basically have different types of nanobots fighting it out in the environment, replicating and fighting it out, almost a war between two colonies of bacteria fighting for control. And the problem with that is that it can cloud the atmosphere with so much dust that it could clog our lungs. And so it might not wipe out the Earth, but it could easily wipe out the human race.
To us, same thing.
Exactly.
No difference.
Well, there would still be an Earth going on. There would still be a chance for another emergence of evolution.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who suggest, here I am trying to be positive, that events of this magnitude are what will cause evolution to take the next major jump. You know, the things that like this that come along, big rocks that hit the planet, suns that sterilize planets, that sort of thing. And then from the ashes, you know, will arise the next generation of intelligence.
It's possible. It's also possible that we will learn enough in the investigation that we will be able to mature ourselves sufficiently.
So what do we do then about the mad scientist in the little lab somewhere in Switzerland who decides to become the gray goo god and to take the Earth to the next level of, you know, even though everybody on it right now is going to more or less go belly up?
Well, I think that in the same way that we developed antivirus software after viral infections,
yeah,
we need to be thinking of developing anti-nanite software while we're developing nanites. As if we have the capacity to create gray goo, then we have the capacity to create something that could stop gray goo. They go together. They really do.
And how long did you say it would take gray goo to do its thing if released?
It's believed to be about 72 hours.
72 hours.
It's sufficiently small enough that it can be caught up in the air currents and travel the air.
Well, I don't know if 72 hours is fast enough for Norton or not.
Yes, the Norton anti-nanotechnology utilities.
That's right. Oh, God. So if you were to actually see the release of this gray goo, what would the eye see? If you could see the release, and it were released, I don't know, 5 or 10 miles from you, and you had a pair of binoculars, what would you see?
You'd probably see things melt. It would just look like things were melting. And there would be probably an energy release. It would probably be hot.
You mean kind of like somebody was taking a big paintbrush the size of Earth and just beginning to move it across the surface of the Earth, and as it went, everything that was turned gray.
Or rather almost that the buildings themselves would start to cave in, the biological beings, ourselves, the animals, would simply fall down and slowly sort of decompose into this gray goo. I'm not sure how fast, how rapid that would be, because part of the sort of break on a gray goo scenario is that there's an enormous amount of energy released when you break all those chemical bonds. And so there's a fine balance between the number of times that you can break a chemical bond and the amount of heat that can be sustained. So it would be slow and hot.
And then finally fast and hot, right?
finally, as it covered the entire Earth's surface, it would just be hot. It would still have the same relative rate of progression everywhere you looked, but there would be more and more spots where it would be proceeding. So it might start out in one location. And frankly, the people who have thought about this think that if there's ever a breakout in a location like that, and there's time to contain it, the only way to contain it is to drop a nuclear weapon on the site immediately.
A nuclear weapon?
Because it's the only way you could actually destroy nanites before they spread irreversibly into the environment.
And a nuclear weapon would be what? Hot enough?
Oh, yes. It would break the chemical bonds. It would just vaporize any nanites in the environment. And you'd have to hope. I mean, you'd do that and cross your fingers and pray that you did it in time.
It's almost unimaginable. Unimaginable.
And yet it's almost here.
When will we see the first examples of, you know, I have a lot of people talk about free energy all the time, and I say, give me a toy. At least just a little toy. Prove to me you've got an over-unity device. A little toy will do, and I never get one. When might we see the first little nanotechnological toy?
Probably within about 5 to 7 years, you're going to see artificial blood. Artificial blood is a small sphere that's made out of diamond. One of the things that we'll get as sort of low-hanging fruit from nanotechnology is very inexpensive sheets of diamond, because it's simply a regular lattice of carbon atoms. If you can make that into a sphere, fill it with very high-pressure oxygen, and then have a small motor on it that sputs out the oxygen at a regular level,
right,
you can use that as artificial blood.
Wow.
Now that, there's already a design for. So now it's a matter of the fabrication process involved in the design. There is a startup in Texas called Zyvex.
Okay.
There's a link to it on the Playful World site. And they're a nanotechnology startup. And so they are working now on the applications of nanotechnology. I think the real threshold isn't going to be these sorts of devices, but what is called the nanocomputer. So a computer built out of atomic level elements. This computer that would be a million times faster than any computer we have today, and 1,000 times smaller than a human cell. The experts in the field, people like Ralph Merkel, who's one of the fathers of nanotechnology, expect that by around 2011 or 2012, the elements will be in place to create a nanocomputer.
That's really soon.
It's really soon.
2012, that's really soon. So, again, I'll ask you one more time. Do you think that socially we're going to be able to keep up with the technological advances? Because socially we're going to have to, or it definitely will do us in. We've got to make some pretty dramatic social advances. And as you look around the planet right now, do you see those occurring at a rate that pleases you when you look at what's happening with nanotechnology?
I don't think it's nearly as fast as I would like it.
Uh-huh.
Whether it's fast enough, I can't say. I think that we need to be able to think almost as if it were magically, that we need to be able to think about the fact that the actions, the consequences of our actions can have a nearly magical effect, that we could almost cast a spell with atoms and either wipe out the Earth or cure someone of cancer. And we have to understand that there's an individual responsibility there. And a social responsibility.
Well, on a scale of 10, how are we doing in the area of individual responsibility right now?
Well, is
that your answer?
Who wants to be a nanotech millionaire? I think that as a culture, we're coming to an understanding of the problem of violence. I think that's one reason why we find violence as abhorrent as we do. It's because there is a cultural understanding of the nature of violence, of the problem of violence, of what happens when you take an instrument of destruction, a gun, and put it in someone's hand. And I think that that's the first step to this broader understanding of what this complete violence of nanotechnology could release. So I'm optimistic.
That was a good answer. I mean, that was a safe answer. I wish I believed as you do. While we may understand, or I don't even know that we understand more about violence. Well, I guess we've been good. We haven't had a big world war in a while. But the micro scale, not macro, but micro scale on Earth right now isn't too good. There's a lot of killing going on out there. A lot of violence. And in this nanotechnological world you're talking about, it wouldn't take but a few bad apples
to ruin the whole bunch.
Right.
Yes, but I think that at the same time, we will be working, and there will be a vast number of people who will be working on how to defeat that problem, how to bring it to a stalemate. So I think that at the same time that you see Grey Goo, you will see 100,000 solutions to that problem.
All right, all right. We're going to break here, and when we come back, I want to turn you over to the audience. This I can't wait for, all right?
All right.
Can you stay?
Absolutely.
Good. Stay right there, then. Y'all are next.
And blue for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day. I'll say goodnight, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Want to take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903.
I watch them go. They're like much more than I.
Now, that certainly is an understatement, isn't it? Remember, what we're talking about right now isn't that far in the future. It's not science fiction. It's what your children are about to encounter. We're about to go to phones. Joe in Alameda, California says, hey, Art, how come I find myself not laughing along? I know, Joe. I understand exactly how you feel, Joe. I've been sort of chuckling along because you've got to keep us some sort of sense of humor about these kinds of things, but I'm with you all the way. And then I think Jim in Denver asks the question of Mark that we ought to tackle first, then we'll go to the phones. It's simple, and it's blunt, Mark. He says, Mark, I'm an African-American. Does this gentleman truly believe this technology will not be abused?
Will not be what?
Abused. Understand why an African-American might ask that?
I understand why I think anyone would ask that. Anyone who's seen the history of the 20th century should really ask, will this technology be abused? I think that we have to consider very rationally the possibility that it will be abused and prepare for it on that basis. If we don't go in with our eyes wide open, I can paint a very pretty picture with the possibilities, but I can also paint a very ugly one with the downside.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to keep both of those points of view in our sights at all times as we move into the 21st century. If we don't, then yes, the potential for abuse will overcome our ability, will overcome our sense of what to do about it.
Most Americans, Mark, think of what we're talking about right now as they think of a science fiction movie, you know, something that, while we might imagine, but, you know, isn't really ever going to happen. The problem with this is it's not science fiction, and it's happening already, right?
You could have said the same thing about cloning just 2 years ago.
Yes, I know. Well, we did.
We did. And now it's likely that a human being is being cloned somewhere.
Indeed.
And so we now are faced with all of the ethical issues that come from that, and this... We have a little bit more lead time. We have at least a good 5 years, probably a good 10 years, before we really have to be able to say, this is how we're going to approach this problem.
Yeah, but in terms of observed human a social evolution, 5 or 10 years, well, I just don't know, Mark. Anyway, listen, we've got a lot of phone calls, and so let us begin. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hi.
Hey, Art, this is Rob, listening to you in Minneapolis on KSTP 1500.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. Thank you.
The wavelength. And I have a brief comment before I ask Mark a question.
Yeah, sure.
The seasons are reversed in Minnesota, in central Minnesota here. It's supposed to be spring, but it's pretty much fall.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, we know what's happening all over the nation, not just there.
Just a note on the weather changes. You know, it's we're feeling it up here.
Yeah, it's obvious everywhere. Anyway, do you have a question?
My question was, in terms of, like, nanotechnology and, I don't know, using... Mark, you talked about the crystal ball and using that to have, you know, whatever the... experience, like video game type experiences, and you talked about the hologram room using nanotechnology. How much energy would a like hologram room like that use?
Oh, that's a really, really, really good question. Energy
would it be similar to like Los Angeles, or would it be more like you know, Nintendo or what?
Yeah, how much power consumption would you imagine being used in something to create eventually a holodeck, let's say?
Well, one of the advantages of nanotechnology is that it works on such a micro level that you can effectively sort of optimize all of the energy usage. And in fact, in nanotechnology, it's important to do that. One of the technical stumbling blocks that people are working through now is how you can create something that's working very quickly at such a small level and doesn't burn itself up in the process. But if you take a look at biology, human beings are very flexible. We move relatively quickly, and all sorts of things from bacteria up to elephants do so. And so there's probably a lot of lessons we'll learn from nature about how to effectively use energy in a conservative way. Now, a human being uses about as much energy as a 120-watt light bulb at any given point in time. So if you're thinking about building an environment, you can probably use that as a convenient multiple.
We're equivalent to a 120-watt
light bulb in terms of the amount of energy we use.
Well, at least we're fairly bright. Yeah, I have to laugh sometimes. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Kathy from Woodbridge, New Jersey.
Hello, Kathy.
And, yeah, I wonder if we're the long-lasting light bulbs or the old Phillips. Yeah, right. Listen, I'm going into the not-so-distant future, and I'm going to ask you something about the future of computers as if they could be the mother and fathers of children born either here because we screwed up, sowing the seeds of life on a new planet, being the guardians on a new planet. You get my drift? In the future, we may mess up so bad down here that we have to program a computer to literally plant the seeds of life and then nurture them and watch them.
Huh.
And I'll end it with this. Guys, once in a while, just catch the PBS and watch the Teletubbies and tell me why these four little things are watched by a computer and never have any parents around them.
All right. That's a lot to tackle. Mark?
If we were going to do some sort of a Genesis project, I suppose is the best name for it, of replanting a Garden of Eden somewhere else, and if there were a computer that we were responsible for bringing human beings into maturity, you would have to be sure that this computer had been raised itself by human beings, because there's a human transmission of values that would be necessary from the humans to the computer to the children. And if you break that continuity, essentially what you're doing is you're breaking what makes us human. And so in that sense, you'd have to make a decision if you were embarking on a project like this, whether you wanted those children to be the offspring, the philosophical offspring, the psychological offspring of a purely rational intellect, or whether you really wanted it to be a much broader, more human intellect.
Wouldn't a purely rational intellect be frightening for humans, dangerous for humans?
I think it would. I think that it would be given to making decisions that we would not normally be given to make ethically, morally. I think that this is the issue that...
It would have its own set of ethics and morals. It would have ethics and morals, but it's its own.
It would be its own, and they would be alien to us because they wouldn't be influenced by the concerns that we would normally think of as being human concerns.
Huh. So it might make decisions that we couldn't possibly understand. Like, for example, if it were running the justice system right now, it might, the very first time a child is brought in who's been fooling around with marijuana, it might decide to euthanize that child on the spot.
Right. It would be capable of justice, but no mercy. And human beings tend to temper all of their justice and all of their actions
with mercy.
With mercy.
But perhaps not most effectively so.
Well, it's a question of what you're considering effective. If you're considering effective in a purely sort of rational frame, then perhaps you're right. But human beings, again, don't think in a purely rational frame. We think in a much broader frame than that.
Well, then we better be careful what we create. West of the Rockies, you're on there with Mark Pesci. Hello.
Yes, this is Jim in L.A., 640 KFI area.
And that's the way. I love people doing promos for their radio stations. Everybody do it. All right, go ahead, sir.
Yeah. Oh, good to have you back, Art. Mark, I was wondering, I was at Disneyland with my wife, well, this is back in the early 70s, and at their, I guess they call it the Haunted Castle, where they have these holograms or whatever you call them.
Yes.
And on the exit, they had one that was in a bell jar, oh, maybe 20 inches or 2 foot high with a woman in it. And she was in 3D, actual 3D. I mean, you could see her arms moving and all this stuff. Somehow they projected it in there. And I was just wondering, how the heck did they do that anyway?
That's actually almost like a magician. It's all done with mirrors. That's a parabolic mirror, so it's a curved mirror,
really?
And the image is projected onto the mirror, but because of the way the light reflects back from the mirror, it resolves into an image that's in front of the mirror, so it looks as though the image is solid.
Wow.
I'll be darned. But I was just curious if they, you know, like, they have to have glasses, I guess, for 3D on television. If they came out with something like that with the games, holy mackerel.
Yes, there's a good question. What would... I think I already know the answer, but what would the movies or the television of tomorrow be in a nanotechnological world? I think I know the answer.
Well, I think that what you're talking about is not piping a program in, but piping a reality in.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're literally, out of the cable is coming the instructions to redesign the environment that you're in the midst of, around whatever drama is going to take place there, and whether that's a drama that you sit and watch as a member of the audience or you participate in.
Mark, you know, even with Turn Off Your TV Week underway right now, word is that we watch, on average, about 4 or 5 hours of television. You know, the old two-dimensional, yes, nice color, but two-dimensional TV now. We watch 5 hours, Mark. In that future that you're describing, not all that far distant, how are you going to ever, I mean, you know, once they've been to Paris and all that, how are you ever going to get them back?
Well, let me give you another example. I don't know if you've heard of a new game that's coming out called Majestic.
It's interesting that you would mention the new game Majestic, because I understand that they have woven my name into it somehow.
Majestic was described by the president of Electronic Arts, who is creating the game, as a cross between CNN and the X-Files.
Uh-huh, yes.
When you sign up for the game, you go onto the web, and you give it all of your contact points. You give it your phone, your fax, your email, your cell phone, and you give it the hours it can call you and annoy you.
And annoy you?
And involve you in the game and call you and tell you that there's a character that's in jeopardy and you have to go do this thing right now. You have to solve this mystery. You have to find the pieces of the vast conspiracy that are swirling around you. So already, without the projection technology, we're finding that the next generation of games, and this isn't really even a PlayStation game, this is almost a game that starts to confuse the real world with the world of the game. So this is now a coming trend. It's expected that this game is going to be wildly popular because it really involves you in a world that's right next door and yet completely in your living room.
Isn't this like the next logical step to fantasy football or baseball or whatever it is that people get so involved in?
Absolutely, and it will appeal to the people who really love the X-Files or Millennium or shows like this, that, or people who listen to Art Bell.
Yeah, my audience. I heard from the people who were constructing this, whatever you call it, game, Majestic, and they are using my name somewhere in it, and I guess I was honored. I guess I'm honored.
I think you should be. I think it's going to be very interesting, and this is, again, the future of entertainment. It's not just something that you sit and watch passively, although I think that'll still exist. People will still make movies as we think of them, or TV as we think of it, where you sit and watch a drama or a performance or a comedy.
Yeah.
But there will also be these other more subtle forms of games where you are literally taken in and you use the best virtual reality machine we have, which is between your ears.
But how are people going to break away from this? How will this not be an irresistible narcotic that will make television look like kid stuff?
500 years ago, Art, all across Europe, theologians, priests, preachers decried a new narcotic that had come out and was destroying the best minds in Europe. Do you know what it was?
Mm-hmm.
The novel.
The novel?
The novel.
The
I mean, you take a look at Don Quixote. Don Quixote, the plot of Don Quixote is that Don Quixote has read so many romance novels, he's gone mad. And he starts to act out on all of these novels that he's read, and it was a popular theory in the day that reading all of these books was going to drive you crazy. So I think that we see over and over that these new ways of telling stories come into our lives and we make room for them. The same way we don't think twice when someone says, oh, I was up all night because I was reading a really good book. Yet at the same time, you'd have to say, wow, that person is addicted to reading this book. That's how good this book was. It was a narcotic. And I think that's how we'll think about Majestic.
But taking leaps ahead, not too Majestic, but farther ahead, why wouldn't a government which is concerned with productivity, and I'm convinced that's one of the main reasons that we have drug laws right now, that we do, and the drug war and all the rest of it, is because they consider drugs to be a war on productivity. So, or a threat to productivity, and so that we have the war on drugs. Why wouldn't we have the war on nanotechnological entertainment for exactly the same reason, Placid, a dangerous narcotic?
Well, I think that nanotechnology is going to upend the whole argument about productivity, because when you can literally fabricate anything that you need on demand, about the only activity of civilization will be the design of those things that can be fabricated on demand.
Yeah, all right, but then what about Zager and Evans, 25-25, you know, our arms hanging useless by our side, right?
I don't know that our arms will be hanging useless by our sides. I don't think that's the case. I just think that the emphasis on what constitutes productivity in the material world is going to move more, I think, into a design sense. That what's going to be important are the things that we can design and play with rather than the things that we actually fabricate.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a couple questions for Mark.
Oh, go ahead.
One is what would be some good effects of this new nanotechnology?
Right.
And my other is what kind of benefits will we get for our human society?
Well, I think one of the things that nanotechnology can promise us is freedom from want. That you can, in fact, go to a place where the population is starving, throw nanites out on the ground, and have them produce food just from raw soil. And it wouldn't matter whether there's a drought or whether there's a flood or anything like that. That you can actually remove human need at a fundamental level by using these machines. I think the second benefit is going to be in medical technology, that we will be able to both observe the human body in incredible detail.
Mark?
Yes.
Quick question. Unless we can make it real expensive, then what would that do to our economy? And I mean the world economy, not just ours.
And that's exactly the point. I think that we're going to see this transition away from the value of the material world. Right now, money and value are based on scarcity.
We have wars over this.
Because there are wars of
scarcity. We have wars over this. What do you think we went to war with, almost went to war with Russia over, and may yet go to war with China over? It's materialism versus the greater common good. That's what we go to war about, right?
Absolutely. But if we've removed the sort of focus of materialism, if we've taken that out of play, then it becomes, in a sense, of war of creativity. And to bring us back to the gray goo versus the anti-gray goo, the virus versus antivirus scenario, that's a war of creativity, of design, not a war of materiel.
But that would require an entire shift from an economy based on consumption or materialism.
On materialism, not on consumption, because we will still be consuming things, but we'll be consuming designs rather than actual products.
Designs. We'll be consuming designs. That's an interesting concept. So then everything we know about money and the way everything is all of that is going to change, isn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Yes. That's no minor change. All right. Bottom of the hour. I'm going to try much harder to be good and get to the phones. Oh, there goes the international line. Don't forget the international line. 800-893-0903.
She's got something to prove my soul, and she knows. If woman can survive, they may find. In the year 35, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 45, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find the thing to choose. Nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 55, your arms hanging limp at your side. Your legs got nothing to do.
Want to take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 775-727-1222 or call the wildcard line at 775-727-1295. To talk with Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Well, our trip into the world of nanotechnology is not a voluntary ride. So perhaps we should rephrase the opening there. Huh. This is a ride you're on, like it or not. As promised, now back to Mark Deshi. And Mark, anytime I ever bring a guest on here, I just want to give them an opportunity to plug a book or plug whatever they've got going. In your case, I know you've got a website. Anything else?
Well, the book, The Playful World, which has been out for 6 months, it's in cover.
And is it generally available in bookstores?
It should be available in most bookstores nationwide. It's carried by all the major chains, and you can buy it on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com if you want to get it online.
Where you get deep discounts.
You do.
People with computers already have advantages, disproportionate advantages to people without them, don't they?
In general, we're starting to see, I guess, what people are calling a knowledge gap. People who have computers, if you think about a child.
But it's a money gap, too. I mean, I can go buy your book for cheap on Amazon, but if I don't have a computer, I've got to go to a bookstore.
Yes, yeah, and you've got to pay the full list price.
Same deal with airplane fares. You can go get very cheap airplane fares on the web. I mean, really cheap compared to what you'll pay at a travel agency.
Although more of this information is starting to migrate now to voice systems on the telephone. So the web and the telephone over the next years will start to become more and more indistinguishable, so that anyone who has access to a telephone will have access to the same kind of rich information and rich discounts.
Isn't it rather likely with broadband that when that arrives for most Americans, let's say, that your telephone won't even be going over a phone line anymore?
That's absolutely right. More and more the phone network is looking like the Internet.
Yeah, it sure is. All right, here we go. On the international line, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Where are you, please?
I'm from Australia. I'm Melbourne. It's Andy here.
Melbourne, Australia. All right. Well, welcome to the show. You have a question?
Yeah, well, as you were saying a minute ago, computer people do, we do have advantages, but we already have problems with bots in IRC kicking us and all sorts of dramas going on left, right, and center with those mob. So what I was wanting to know also...
Can we stop for just a second with bots in IRC? All right, IRC is Internet Chat Relay, or Internet Relay Chat, or whatever it is. Anyway, it's a place where people gather on the Internet, and they have what are called bots. And these bots keep control of things when humans aren't around. You know about those, right, Mark?
Yes.
Okay, well, I didn't know whether a lot of the audience, not computer savvy, wouldn't have known, but the bots are already there on these groups. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, yeah, well, they're basically ruling us in the Art Bell IRC chat room already.
Yeah, I've heard that, yes.
It can happen. What I would like to know is about... if there's software for these this nanotechnology, you know, if we're going to have a problem as such as a Microsoft software and buggy beta testing and all sorts of drama with it, or if it's chemical or how it works.
Well, right now they're thinking to design nanocomputers not along the lines of computers as we think of them with electrons flowing across silicon surfaces, but in fact they're taking a page out of the very first computers, which were built out of mechanical parts. You think about an old mechanical adding machine. Perhaps people remember these from the 1950s and the 1960s. They were wheels and gears.
Yes.
And in fact, it seems that the right way to make a nanocomputer is to build it out of these very small components in wheels and gears, wheels of carbon and other elements that would work together in the same way. So in a sense, although they're much faster than the computers we see today, they are mechanical. Now, as to software testing, we're going to have exactly the same issues with buggy software that we do in the world with our computers today. And that perhaps is the biggest problem, because even if we manage to effectively prevent someone from producing something that's toxic with nanotechnology, that doesn't mean that a computer with bad software can't do it.
So then the blue screen of death in the year 2050 might be gray goo.
The gray goo of death.
Oh, jeez. All right, on the international line, you're on the air. Where are you calling from, please?
Hello, I'm calling from Australia again, just like your last caller there.
Yes, sir.
In Darwin.
Oh, Darwin, all right.
Yes. My name's Aaron, by the way, and I've got a question relating to this nanotechnology.
All right.
Basically, isn't a part of life the struggles we face in order to reach our wants and needs? So isn't creating this instantaneous gratification removing a part of our existence?
A social question. In other words, without the wants and needs that we struggle for today, if these wants and needs are all delivered to us so easily in the future, then what happens to human struggle? A good question.
Aaron's making a very good point, Art. There's no question that the way we visualize or philosophize about what human ends are, what our purpose is in the world, is going to be radically redefined by a pervasive nanotechnology. That you're essentially saying that part of what constitutes human need is just there. It's there like the air that you breathe. But we also think that if you take a look at the pyramid of needs, this was constructed by Maslow back in the 1930s, breathing is at the very bottom. We don't really normally worry about breathing.
No.
And so in the same way, the other material needs for housing, for food,
yes,
are going to be, in a sense, subsumed down to that level. Mm-hmm. And so we will focus on the higher end of that, which is creativity, expression, the more artistic pursuits.
Doesn't sound like a big world for the blue-collar worker.
Well, if you take a look at the whole sort of progression of American culture over the last 50 years has progressively reduced the role of the blue-collar worker.
Well, I know, but that would eliminate it.
There's no question that within the generation of a widespread nanotechnology, people would not be fabricating things per se.
Okay. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hello.
Hello. My name is Michael. I'm calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Yes, Michael.
In your conversation tonight, Mark, with Art, you've done two rather significant things.
you've made the case for one world government in a more powerful way than it has ever been made on this program and on almost any other program.
Yep.
In the United States. And that, of course, is something that frightens a lot of religious people, people who believe in the Bible, mm-hmm. particularly religious conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
But the case that you've made is, it can't be argued. This is something that is inevitable.
It can be argued and fought over. I mean, that's the reason right there for a war, and you know it.
Yeah, but...
Let's ask him about that. You really have, as the caller points out, made the case for a one-world government, the necessity for it, before tackling any kind of technology like this, yes?
I really actually disagree. I have the same, I think, very natural qualms about centralization of authority in this kind of system. I don't think that's the answer, because I don't think that any centralized state can be so omniscient as to prevent something from happening. I think what you need is as much decentralization as possible.
Well, let me just make my point about it. People have been thinking about this. Serious thinkers have been thinking about it for well over 50 years and actually working towards that because they find it as an unavoidable thing. The problem is we can't talk about one world government as such, so we talk about free trade. But realists in the world today know that we must go in this direction for the dangers that you have pointed out here tonight, and your own arguments argue against you. I won't attempt to do it in this short space of time. But I would like to make another point. Your discussion of technology has also made another very significant point. You have made the case for the 3,500-year-old Genesis account of Moses and the Tower of Babel. And because you have made this so effectively by saying that, yes, what mankind is doing is actually recreating Genesis in his own time. And because you have done this, you have given people who are religious conservatives out there and all kinds of religious people who are normally very paranoid about this thing an opportunity to enter into the discussion, to think more rationally about it, not be knee-jerk in their reaction to the whole idea of one world government. And actually, we can begin now talking about a one world radio program on the lines of Coast to Coast AM, which will begin introducing the entire world simultaneously to the ideas, opportunities, and problems that we're talking about right now.
I've even got the new name, sir. From Coast to Coast to Coast to Coast to Coast to Coast to Coast.
Well, I think instead of looking at 20 million people in the Art Bell audience, we ought to start seriously and realistically talking about a 2 billion person audience.
Well, I'll tell you, my network is working on it, sir. I can't reveal any more than that right now, but trust me when I tell you, from coast to coast to coast to coast is closer than you might imagine. His first point was an interesting point. And how would you make the case, Mark, that the kind of technology you're talking about wouldn't necessitate a single control and a very strong control at that?
There's a lovely line. It's my favorite line in the entire Star Wars trilogy when Princess Leia turns to General Tarkin and says, "The more you tighten your grip, the more star systems slip through your fingers."
Yeah.
When you impose order, uh-huh. escalate chaos, and that's probably the worst of all possible situations.
Yes, but chaos...
I would think want to have as many different centers working on different problems as possible. They may want to be coordinated. We can see with the internet the kinds of loose coordination, or even in the nanotechnology community, the kinds of loose coordination where researchers are aware of each other's work. They're trying to engender public discussion, public awareness, public debate. I think the idea of having a radio program where people can be educated about these issues is incredibly beneficial. It's a thing that should happen.
I agree. But, I mean, you're such a social optimist, I can't believe it. I mean, somehow you see things that just aren't happening today, aren't even trending today, and you're applying them to, you know, this incredible new technology. And I don't know. I guess the glass is just always half full for you, huh, Mark?
You can't say that, Art. I definitely have my nightmares. I've lived with the ideas of this. Part of the reason I'm well-versed in nanotechnology is because I was around when the key people involved in inventing it were actually inventing it. This was back at MIT in the very early 1980s.
But, Mark, as long as we have separate nation states and rogue nation states, and that difference and that separation, this kind of technology, I mean, begin to apply the probabilities, go crunch the numbers on, you know, somebody like Gaddafi getting hold of something like this. And as long as the nation states are all separate, you've got to imagine that as a possibility, then your chaos numbers are really going to get you.
But in a sense, you haven't even gone far enough. It's not rogue nations that we necessarily need to worry about, but as you pointed out earlier, the rogue human beings. Even
rogue,
had one world government.
Rogue Harry down the street.
Exactly. Is that one world government going to be so powerful and so omniscient that it could keep the chains on every single person? I mean, I don't think, A, that anyone wants that, and B, I don't think that's actually possible. And so I think we're confronted with the fact that we are what we are.
Okay, well, then that in itself is a social comment. We're absolutely stubborn individuals who would never allow anything like that to happen, even though it was on the way. And so we'll be then the same stubborn individuals who'll be toying with this new technology.
Who will be toying with all aspects of it, though. We'll be toying with the upsides and the downsides. And I think that if you can encourage as much breadth, if you have children who understand it.
Yeah, but how many bad days with Grey Goo do you need?
Well, it's a question. How many bad days does your body have with bacteria? A lot of them. And yet your body manages to survive. And I think that if we look toward the natural world, we can see that we can sustain certain types of injuries. There might be some that would be a knockout punch, but most of them our body is prepared for. Even for the ones we aren't prepared for, our body learns, adapts, and attacks. I think that's the metaphor. I think that's the reason why I have this optimism.
All right.
Because we can look to the natural world.
All right. I'm not doing this enough. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hi.
Good evening, Art. This is Chris in Los Angeles.
Yes, sir.
Listening to you at 640 KFI AM radio.
That's the way to do it.
Okay. Let's. You guys have touched the subject that I'd like to get into. It's a little bit more on the wild side of this. This gray goo matter is pretty terrifying, but let's look at something else. What if we could take the nanotechnology, release it into a human body, it goes into our fat cells or sperm cells, whatever, and learns the T cells, and becomes a cell management system that we can control. So as we're aging and if there's any heart defects, the nanotechnology reports it, say, to a wristband that we wear, and it alerts us, and it automatically gets, we give it a signal and approval to go ahead and do the repairs. Now we take it a step further. Say we want to have available to us programs that we can insert. For example, we want to become a cat for an hour. We want to play with our cat.
Huh.
And we put in the program, and the nanos go in, and for an hour we become an animal of our choice. Or say we want to become a football player. We can increase our size and our mass through the nanotechnology. Okay? Now, to take it a little bit further, say this device we wear becomes an interface to computers or to communicating with other people.
Certainly is going to destroy the steroid market.
But, you know, what about these people who have frozen themselves and they're waiting for the technology to cure their diseases? I mean, this would probably be the only thing that could be capable of doing, reviving them. Or a dead person, you know, what if it would be pretty scary if we could injected into Einstein's remains and rebuild his body, all of a sudden he comes to life. You know, what kind of out-of-body experience would he talk about?
It's funny that you should mention this. The first major book on nanotechnology called The Engines of Creation was published in 1986. I read a very early draft of it in 1983, and there was an entire chapter which talked about exactly this. It was basically debating how much of the remains of someone did you need before you could reanimate them. And I mean, I read that chapter, I was frightened by it, and yet at the same time you can see see that when the technology is sufficiently advanced, those kinds of applications become very easy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you've got my wheel spinning. I don't know about you guys, but who needs a hologram if you can just become something?
So right. Then, in other words, if you had enough of a person's just basic DNA, which could come from blood or hair or skin scrapings or whatever, that might be enough information to rebuild a duplicate of that person, a real duplicate, not a clone, but a duplicate, right?
Well, clearly, if you're talking about the person is a combination of the body. It's not just the genes. If you're talking about Einstein, and I think they have Einstein's brain in a jar somewhere.
They do.
And so it's conceivable that you could reanimate someone with sufficient remains. Again, we think that most of the qualities of the person are kept inside the brain, although there's some argument about where it all is. So it wouldn't necessarily be completely faithful, but it would be a reasonable fact.
You have a way of describing nanotechnology, which is both at the same time frightening and very understandable for the average person. I've had other experts on, and they engage in language that the average person simply cannot understand. So you articulate this very well. Did you do that in your book?
Yes, that was really one of the main theses of my book, was to take these ideas that have been, in a sense, locked in the ivory towers and put them in terms that everyone can understand, because I look at children's toys and I show how children's toys like Legos can be used as a metaphor for understanding what nanotechnology is.
Legos, huh?
Legos.
All right, listen, Mark, we're at a juncture point where I always ask my guests, and, you know, I can't even... Where are you?
Los Angeles.
You're in L.A.
I am.
All right. I always ask my guests right here whether they want to do the final hour or they've done too much and they're ready to rest. You don't sound ready to rest.
No, you've got my wheels turning.
And they turn pretty quickly at that. All right, then hold it right there. We'll come back and do another hour. I'm Art Bell. Indeed, only in America. Actually, that may not be true. Wonder what the Chinese are doing right now in this area. Fortunately for us, they're very socially advanced over there in communist China now, and We don't really need to worry about what they're doing with this kind of stuff, right?
Take a ride? Well, call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
Certainly is. I was listening during the news to a guy, a very nice guy who sells the Oric vacuum cleaners that we need today. So you've got to wonder, in the future, you've got dirt around your house. But I don't think you're going to need a great big vacuum cleaner in the nanotechnological world. You're going to just need this little thing and you release it and it goes and it eats all the dirt, and I mean all the dirt. All right, once again, for all my friends overseas, give it a try. Take the plunge, whether you're in Europe or Asia or North or South America, wherever you are, save here in the U.S. and Canada. Try this. Call 800-893-0903. Worldwide will pay the bill. Doesn't matter where you are. China, I don't care. We'll pay the bill. Worst case, get hold of the AT&T operator and have her dial 800-893-0903. All right, back now to my guest, Mark Pesce. Mark?
Yes.
Okay, still hanging in there, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Very good. All right, well, lots of people want to talk to you, so here we go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Good morning.
Hi, my name is Ray. I'm calling from Ogden, Utah. Listen to you on 570 KNRS out of Salt Lake.
Good for you.
Okay, no, here's the big problem I'm having with all this. I can mentally picture it, but there are so many things that bother me about it. Okay, I'm a martial arts enthusiast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an amateur musician. And I'm a student of Zen Buddhism or Chan Buddhism, whichever you want to call it. And it, to me, without a human element of striving, struggling, and aspiring, and I could just say to myself, bang, I'm a master swordsman, or bang, I'm an enlightened Buddhist, or
yes,
bang, I'm a really good musician. It would all be hollow and empty.
It's a lot like another question we had, really. Very much like it. And it's not an easy answer, is it, Mark?
No, I think that it's going to displace some of the things that we think of as being worth striving for and replace them with others. I think that it's in the human nature to strive, to improve, to get better. And the question is, when certain things become easy, for instance, I live in Los Angeles, it's a huge city, but it's very easy for me to get across it. Transportation is not an issue, unless I happen to be going around at rush hour. And so it's changed what I consider a challenge appropriately to my level of ability. So every time our abilities extend, what becomes important, what becomes challenging also changes. Now, I don't believe that you'll be able to flick a switch and become the Buddha, because I think that's a spiritual change. We're talking about material manifestations of the world.
Okay.
We're not
okay.
talking about the nature of spiritual changes, but I think that one of the things that this could foment, that the nanotechnology revolution could foment, is an examination of what truly is important. Once you've satisfied your basic material needs, what then is important?
And another thing I did want to mention is that it sounds to me a lot that what we're talking about tonight, it has been more or less predicted in James Redfield's books, Tenth Insight and the Celestine Prophecy. He mentioned something in one of those books about the possibility of there being such a synergy between humans and machines.
I think that this is a real, I think that's a core part of it. The entire passage of human history from the invention of fire through the present day has been an increasing human ability to work with the material world, to get finer and finer levels of control over it. And we're now just in that last half mile, that last sprint before complete control of the material world, which brings with it a whole host of problems and a whole host of opportunities.
Indeed.
All right, I appreciate the call, sir. I guess I would like to ask about Mr. Oryx, a very nice fellow who sells his Oryx vacuum cleaner that still goes after 25 years. I was listening to his little commercial during the news. Not everybody might have caught it, but they know what I mean. You know, how's Mr. Oryx going to be doing there in another 50 years?
Well,
there's already been proposed what we would call household nanites, which will eat the dust off the floor, and in fact, use the dust off the floor as the thing that keeps them powered.
How about cat barf?
They'd be able to do it off of any sort of organic substance. It would be a general purpose device that would be looking for things that don't belong in the environment. And so they'd probably be talking to some device that has a rough idea of how the environment should be. Now, you don't want it to eat your books.
No, but I mean, a hairball-filled cat barf, I'm sick of cleaning those up.
That you can probably actually do something with. You might actually, maybe what you'll have is a magic wand in your hand, and you'll point it at the device, and that will then tell the nanites in the room to run over and eat the cat barf.
Nanites, cat barf, now! First time caller line, you're on the air with Mark Pesci, hello.
Hello, Mr. Bell.
Yes.
Great show this evening, or this morning, I should say.
Yes, it is morning.
A few questions. One, for you, have you ever considered a weekly television show, say like on Sci-Fi Channel or something?
Yeah, I've been
like
offered that, by the Sci-Fi Channel and about a million others, and I've turned every one of them down. I'm not going to do TV.
Okay. Well, good answer.
Honest answer.
Oh, well, honest answer. As far as your guest goes, Mark, I have a question for you. The reason I'm asking this is because I'm finishing college and hopefully I'm going to be going into the military, but I saw a program about nanotechnology on the History Channel, and one concept that they put out was the use of nanotechnology for a skin covering, something that I guess you would inject into your skin or put on you, something that could change colors, like if you were a Navy SEAL, or something that could provide a barrier for protection against the environment. Is something like that practical? How far away are we from that sort of technology, and would it be safe?
It certainly would be practical. It's depending on the qualities of that kind of covering.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively easy to do because it's a polymer, and so really what you want is some sort of active polymer that can be controlled. Is it safe? They would probably design it to be at least as safe as a wetsuit.
Huh.
You'd have to do something like that. Now, if it binds directly to your skin, you're going to have another level of problems because you're going to deal with perspiration and all sorts of issues like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you could definitely see those kinds of things. Those will happen, I would say, 5 to 10 years out.
Wow.
Because those are almost the benefits of material science. And then the question is, how active are those materials? So you take a look at the enormous leaps that are being made in display technology now, where we have what they're calling bioluminescent LEDs.
Uh-huh.
And things like this. These are all sorts of parts of the same revolution that's going on with using materials for surfaces that have particular qualities.
So I guess like something like, for instance, if your skin, you know, in the future, if you're in a bad accident and you get burned all over, I guess the idea of some sort of skin covering that would basically mimic your own skin, I guess, you know, the potential for that is also there.
Yes, the potential for that's also there, although I think that by the time we do that, you'd probably also then be able to take your genome into high gear and regrow new skin.
Well, one quick question. As far as, like, car technology, do you know if anybody's working on something to where you would be able to, like, maybe, you know, if you buy a car in just plain white, by, you know, changing something, spraying something, whatever, it would instantly change the color of your car?
Uh-huh.
That is one of the things that people are working on. This is, again, a lot of work that's going on in material science. There's a big push toward what we call digital ink right now, which is another type of material which allows you to have, say, a book, but the book's pages are actually active. They're not printed so much as they are electronic, and they portray something, and yet the surface is very flexible and very thin like a book. And so you can see that as being a very easy extension from a book cover to a car cover.
You know, I was just thinking as he was talking about the car. I used to be a police dispatcher. Boy, it would complicate that job. You're looking for a green Chevy, right? Then you're looking for a blue Chevy and a yellow Chevy and an orange Chevy. And pretty soon you're not even looking for a Chevy anymore. You're looking for a Ford because it just morphed into a Ford.
No, but probably what the police officer would be to fire a dart of nanites at it, which would tag the car and then make it possible to capture no matter what the car looked like.
Well said. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Mark Pesci. Hi.
This is Nick, another 640 man in L.A.
Yes,
this
sir.
This blockbuster program is one of the three best I've ever heard.
Glad you're enjoying
several
it.
Years. That last caller really leads into my double question, because the two questions are related, about productivity and about violence for hire. But that's going to be great when your closet's going to start looking like a broom closet. You have a jar for every article of clothing you want to wear. you just spray poof, you're dressed in whatever you need to protect yourself. The two questions, this is on the other extreme rather than right next to your body. In the whole world, you're going to have sheep herders in Mongolia. You're going to have jitney drivers in Brazil. Millions of workers suddenly going to telework centers to support the new technology. That's great. Productivity is wonderful, but there's one downside, is that everything they do will have absolutely nothing to do with their immediate environment, which will mean whole cultures will be just completely absorbed, maybe you call it a kind of a cultural gray goo type of concept. And that leads to my main question, which is, you're going to have boxing matches, bare knuckles matches, really brutal games that, you know, some rogue countries will be willing to supply, real blood being shed, real people being killed, like in the movie Gladiator, and even far more repulsive practices in which the participants are either drugged or coerced into participating, even...
All for entertainment.
Yeah, even torture for entertainment, and you can't stop it because it'll go through the underground, through hundreds of servers or email. There'll be three basic means of transmission, direct server networks, email, which is store and forward, where the computers don't always have to be on, or just removable media like CDs and VHS and the like. I'll get off the air while you address the second problem because it's concerned me for a long time as I've studied the Internet and what the next step will be.
Mark?
Well, I mean, you can see the parallels already with the sort of very far end of the pornography industry. This is something that really is already in existence that some people will always be looking for, the certain types of things that will thrill them. I think that the thing that matters in a situation like this is that there are people out there who are monitoring, who are actively working to monitor this. When you look at the issue of productivity, of where people are going to go in a culture like this, I think people will find the issues that concern them. We talk about striving for goals, what goals are important, and it may be that the goals of production will be left behind in favor of the goals for sort of humankind, for the kind of greatest benefit, so that if you find something like this that's going on at a subterranean level, perhaps someone who's been freed from a blue-collar job actually would take an interest in finding and solving these kinds of problems, so that the social displacements that happen may be made up for.
Gosh, you're an optimist. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesce, the optimist. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes. Your turn. Where are you, sir?
Bluefield, West Virginia.
Okay.
They don't carry your last hour, so I'm going to have to ask, if you don't mind, after I ask my second question, if you could keep them on. It'll be a short answer, I'm sure. The first one, both of you can give me your opinion on. Have you read The Cat's Cradle by Kurt von Vonnegut?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
So you know the premise of some kind of foreign agent being created and getting out of the lab and destroying the world's not new.
No.
So I don't think with that history, and I'm sure it goes back further, I haven't read one that's older than that, that's still going to be kept on men's minds. So I think there's always going to be somebody that's going to be looking and watching out for that kind of stuff. Although, you know, there's no guarantees.
You're an optimist too, aren't you?
An optimistic realist.
I'm not sure that works, but all right.
Mm-hmm. The second question for Mark is, can those nanoprobes be turned against the Internet?
Uh-huh.
Well, the Internet is coming through so many different media these days. It's either over a wire, or it's over the air, or it's over a fiber optic link, or it's over a laser link, or it's over microwave. And so it's not clear that you could take out the whole Internet in a situation like that. You could certainly, say, produce a nanite bomb that would take out the physical wiring somewhere, or perhaps produce a microwave storm so that people couldn't get their calls through. So in a limited sense, you could do it. Whether it could do it in the global sense, that's not clear. I mean, certainly if you produced something that was just the gray goo, then that would take the Internet out because it would take everything else out with it.
But as you see the Internet now, or even in its immediate future, its broadband future, nanotechnology would not directly apply to destroying it.
You could take out sections, but I don't think you could take out the whole thing.
Yeah, right. Exactly. All right. Good. At least there's some limit there. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Good morning.
Hello, gentlemen. This is Lee out of Seattle and Como.
How you doing?
Art, I agree with you in 100,000 spades that this man is a cockeyed optimist. You know, let me say I'm not a Luddite. I read a tremendous amount of science fiction. I've read about this, but it just scares the hell out of me. The combination of this, especially with our breakthroughs in genetic technology, is just astoundingly scary. You know, but to me, it would be like, in our present form of society, I believe it would be like giving a group of cannibal headhunters an armed atomic bomb and just letting them play around with it. I'm going to address a military question in a minute, but let me make a couple other observations. I came across a very interesting thing that applies to this. As a quote from someone, it says, "Experience is a hard teacher. It gives the test first and the lesson afterwards." And when we start dealing with these super technologies like we're getting into now, we're only going to have, you know, one chance for a world-changing mistake. I think particularly the thing that scares me with this technology is its application to tyranny. You know, and as you said, Art, I mean, let's look at the examples we've got. Mm-hmm. Like Mr. Fuller pointed out 50 years ago, we could feed all the world and we could manage all our energy needs. We've got everything we need under our current technology, but we're not doing so.
Right.
We're still killing the world with, you know, out-of-date petroleum pollution.
That's right.
And that's because people are making money and they're controlling power with it. This is just going to be that ramped up 100 times. What if a dictator, for instance, wanted to, you know, secretly assassinate someone? He could key one of these things into their genome,
mm-hmm.
have it so it would only strike one person, it would hunt them out, it would go into their brain, pop a blood vessel, and then they would destroy themselves. It looked like he had a stroke and no one would ever know. Let me cite an example from The Outer Limits. I know some people you had on just recently.
Yes.
They did a show about this. Incredibly interesting and frightening. This is going to take, you know, a tremendous amount of programming to make these work. They're incredibly specialized, but yet they're very stupid because they're so small. This guy was a medical application, and they injected these things inside of a body for their experimental first-generation nanites. And they told them to protect and repair his immune system. So they went in there and they repaired him all right. But then they discovered he wasn't good enough, and so they started changing his skin, adding ribs. Pretty soon his head started itching in the back, and he discovered he had a second pair of eyes in the back of his head.
Hmm.
They made him better than he was, and that was because the programming wasn't done properly.
Oh, but programming is always done properly. I mean, does Windows 98 ever crash?
Exactly. I would never want to inject anything like this in my body, not if I can help it. But the problem is, you know, it could be spread around the world and you wouldn't even know it was there. So how does the guest address the tyrannical aspects of this?
I think that the thing we're going to need to develop is a very powerful defense. There's no question about that. I think that we're going to need to take a look at the human body and use that as the model and really inflate the idea of the human body and its elaborate defenses against penetration and say, okay, we need to replicate that in a nanotechnology world. We need to bring those defenses not only inside the body but outside the body.
How about this could be targeted against specific people and you wouldn't even know it was in your environment until it killed you?
But you would, because you'll have nanites in your blood that are checking for foreign invaders.
You know, the people that have the power right now can control us. They can do that kind of programming, but the common people won't be able to buy that.
Well, they'll have it first, and the people with the money will have the bots, and everybody else will have, well, they'll be in the pots. The haves and the have-nots, bot-wise, nanotechnologically speaking. I'm Art Bell. Good morning.
Sweet dreams are made of...
You know, I was just thinking, listen to the words of this. It really defines the current social human condition on Earth almost perfectly. Are we ready for nanotechnology, huh?
Want to take a ride?
Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
Now, come on, get off your worldwide dust and give me a call internationally. Figure it out. Call the operator, the AT&T operator. Beg her. She'll help you. 800-893-0903. That's 800-893-0903. It's actually free from anywhere in the world. Oh, look what Ben in Calgary, Alberta says. He says, hey, Art, if you think Microsoft on your computer is unpleasant, can you imagine it in your body? Once again, the prince of micro... I better not say that. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you.
Would it be possible, do you think, this is just an offhand question, to design a nanotechnological something or another that would literally go around the world and destroy every single cell phone? Is that a yes?
That's an I don't know. I think once we get GPS in all of them, it'll certainly be easy to track them down.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Mark Pesci. Hello.
Oh, good evening, Art. John from Kauai, KQNG 570, listening to you out here. Thanks again for making us all stop and think. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
My question is twofold. Number one, could nanites be made to, like, be dispersed and then sit dormant, maybe recharging on solar power until they were globally awakened?
Yes, absolutely. Question with that is, what signal do you use to awaken them?
Right. Secondly, if I had a nanite and I took it in for inspection, could it be detected under a normal laboratory microscope at, say, 250 to 500 power?
It would depend on the scale of the nanite. Most nanites, we think, will be between the size of a bacterium and a virus. It would depend on the complexity of them. And so you can't really see a virus with a 500 times microscope. You can see a bacterium.
Then my last question to you, Art, is...
Mm.
Would you ask him if it could be sprayed in an aerosol form from an aerial tanker?
Sure. And for you, caller?
Yes, sir.
Regarding the signal?
Uh-huh.
We all know what it is. It's...
clap on.
Let's clap on. All right, thank you, and later. I don't think you would have to go to the extreme of spraying this stuff from anything, would you? Or would there be instances where you would?
Well, I guess it would depend on what your needs were. I mean, if there is an immediate problem and you wanted an immediate application, it's the same thing we use normal materials for. You use a spray when you want to apply something directly over a particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know it's there, rather than waiting for it to find whatever its target is.
Gotcha. Grey goo? Grey goo. Wild card line, you're on the air with Mark Pesci. Hi.
Yeah, hi, yeah, this is Franco calling from LA, KSI.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Mark, would it be possible to use nanotechnology to help us, like, with the supernatural sector, the area as far as helping detect, you know, all these, you know, shadow people, the ghosts and the spirits, and I'll listen out the air. Thank
Very
you.
Very interesting. In other words, to learn something about what we now consider to be the metaphysical.
Well, it would depend on whether there's anything measurable by a nanite in that area. Now, clearly, the one thing that a nanite can do is it can make very, very precise and fine measurements to a detail and to a degree that normal scientific instruments aren't normally able. And so if there is something that is physically present in a phenomenon, a nanite might be able to detect it.
Hmm. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesci. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, hello. Where are you?
Okay, this is Mark from Grafton, Wisconsin.
All right.
Okay, when you mentioned the gray goo in the beginning, it was really fascinating, and it kind of reminded me of, I don't know, the Big Bang, or at least the theory of the Big Bang.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Big Bang in a way.
An expansion, right, if you comment on this. kind of a not so down to earth comment, but like the ultimate nanites, I guess, if you can look at it, it's the Big Bang released stuff. You know, maybe the ultimate nanites are nuclear material itself. I mean, because, you know, if what we build what we build everything with in science, you know, it's some stuff that already exists. You know, nuclear, you know, atoms, molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from the Hindu and Buddhist perspective, we live in an interactive universe, so, you know, these ultimate nanites that I call nuclear material, I mean, we're interacting with them all the time. You know, the way the Buddhist and Hindu philosophy goes is that there's, you know, for everything there's a cause. There's just an endless chain of cause and effect. So we know we're interacting with something. My point is we're interacting with these ultimate nanites, I call, you know, the stuff of the universe. So,
well, you're getting metaphysical on us.
Well, it's metaphysical. My point is with this, again, is even everything that we create, you know, like even, I remember when the Cray computers, you familiar with Cray?
Yes, of course.
Cray computer systems.
Yes.
Their computers were approaching even the human form because they started using artificial blood plasma to cool the computer systems. So the point is...
Well, I guess you could think of it as artificial blood plasma, but
yeah.
I don't.
What my point is to Mark is what's his you know, with respect to scale or the end, how far we can go with nanotechnology. That's why I bring up this, you know, kind of a metaphysical point. What's his view on scale? I mean, how far can we take it?
Well, it's going to be a complete transformation of the material world. Now, because we live in the material world, because we interact with and are engaged in a chain of causality in the material world, if we completely transform the material world, there is no choice but to completely transform what we are. Humanity on the other side of the nanotechnology revolution does not look like the humanity of the early 21st century. As Art points out repeatedly, there may not be any humanity at all. We may have pressed the wrong button, or maybe there was a software glitch and Microsoft in our bodies decided to just melt us all down. That said, it is possible that this transformation will take us somewhere else.
I wonder what they'd call that operating system. Wilson the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hi.
Hi, this is Quentin in Portland.
Hello, Quentin.
I have two comments, and the last caller kind of led up to it, the first one. My opinion is that technology is a way to reflect back to ourselves our own makeup. I mean, we learn about, like you were saying earlier, you know, we create a mechanical, emotional human, and we learn about our own emotions. And I think that nanotechnology... really gets down to the level of quantum physics and consciousness, and you know, once we get into that level, we're in the arena of our consciousness affecting reality. You know, and we're using technology to do that, but I think that we already have that ability already within the human form. I mean, I'm thinking of someone like Jesus who manifested the loaves and fishes directly out of energy in the universe, and So I just see that nanotechnology is kind of a stepping stone to a spiritual awakening, because, like you say, we're getting into a time when we'll be directly manipulating physical reality.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly correct.
Yeah. If we have that kind of ability right now, a direct control over matter, it's latent. It's not something we normally imply. And yet technologies are the way we convince ourselves that we have control over the material world. And so nanotechnology is, in a sense, that last step of control, that last actualization in which we've managed to prove to ourselves that we really do have the degree of control over the material world that was always latent.
But at some point, nanotechnology, for example, would allow a virtual duplication of every miracle pestilence that occurred from God or Jesus when he was on earth. All of these things could be manifested by nanotechnology.
In the twinkling of an eye.
So then how, in a twinkling of an eye, so then how do we separate ourselves from God at that point?
Well, you'd have to, I think, be careful about psychological ego inflation. That's probably going to be one of the major psychiatric disorders of a nanotechnology world.
I'm sure.
People believing that they are the entire universe. And so, there's going to have to be a balance. And again, when you strike the sort of cautionary note, what we're saying is that we have to find that balance between our incredibly realized abilities as individuals and the fact that we need to keep existing as a species.
Is there any way for people to get in contact with you, Mark? Email addresses?
Email address is right there on the website, right on the front page of playfulworld.com. I encourage everyone. I got a couple of emails during the program.
Okay. What is it, just for grins?
Mark, with a K, at playfulworld.com.
That's easy. Okay. Mark at playfulworld.com. That's really easy. All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, you have Hum.
Yes, I'm a first-time caller.
Yes, sir.
I'm calling from El Paso, Texas.
All right.
I'm KTSM 690.
Right.
And my name is Gary.
Okay, Gary, fire away.
Yes, sir. Is this Art Bell?
It sure is.
One question, sir. Well, I have two questions. One, first of all, are we live across all 50 states of the United States of America?
Say that again, please.
Are we live across the whole world?
Yes, entire world.
Yeah, okay. My name is Gary, and I'm calling from El Paso, Texas.
I got that already.
Okay. The reason why I'm calling, sir, Art Bell, is because I'll just say that from my understanding of physics and the universe and astronomy, one time I posed a question to a man that was a planetarium director.
All right, you're going to have to get on subject here, or we're going to have to move on.
Oh.
I've got a guest. Do you have a question for him?
Yes.
What is it?
It's about the nano world, right?
Yes.
Okay. I want to ask one question. What is the definition
of nanotechnology?
Yes, sir.
All right. That's probably something we should have really defined at the beginning of the program. What is your definition of nanotechnology?
Nanotechnology is the human ability to build devices out of individual atoms. So we take a look at the natural world, you take a look at a piece of wood, it's carbon atoms and oxygen atoms and hydrogen atoms that have been grown by nature's nanotechnology, a tree, biology. Mm-hmm. And so nanotechnology is our ability to take individual atoms and assemble them in any way we want to create anything we need.
International Line, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hi.
Hi.
Where are you, sir?
I'm in Canberra.
England?
Canberra, Australia.
Australia.
And basically, I've just got a comment, something that I think is pretty good. First, I want to say hi to Mastrax in IRC. My comment is, you're talking before about the possible deployments of nanoprobes. Maybe, if you think about it, some chemtrails are just that. Deployment of nanoprobes.
Well, I it could be. And there might be some applications where it would be sprayed. There are a lot of people who believe that we are being sprayed with one thing or another, Mark. That's what they mean by chemtrails. Would that be an effective way to disperse some early forms of nanotechnology?
If you're looking to disperse things into the environment that would be protective.
Yes.
So things that would protect against gray goo, you'd probably want first to test them very carefully in the laboratory to make sure that they are not dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, release them first at controlled levels and then very widespread levels into the environment. And this way, we will end up constructing an immune system that will help us defend against gray goo.
Kind of a gray goo SDI.
Yes, a gray goo antivirus.
Gotcha. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hi.
Greetings, Art. Greetings, Mr. Pesce. I think one thing that hasn't been properly really touched on, a few people have addressed it, but putting this in the context of a national security state and the exponential erosion of privacy that we've had in this country through surveillance technology and what was originally military technology applied to civilian law enforcement. Maybe we should introduce Mr. Pesce to Nick Begich. Mr. Begich, if you put in the context of that, of electronic mind control, of mind control technologies of which there are patents, of the CIA's history of mind control experiments,
mm-hmm.
And again, of this growing, it's a cliche, but this growing police state, the means of mass control of individuals is
never ending. You could determine each individual's reality, not only their perception but the response to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been listening to this just absolutely glued. It's like listening to Michio Kaku in the sense of how theoretically fascinating it is. In practical application, I'm afraid that the end result of this is going to be nanological chains.
All right. Well, Mark, in other words, there we are again. The one world government, the iron fist upon all of us. He somehow sees that completely tied into the development of this technology. I mean, in some ways, I see why he fears that, because we're kind of moving in that direction now.
Yeah.
I mean, what if they have the tools to really make it so?
The question here is there a they in this situation? Nanotechnologies will be both probably very easy to make, which is the great benefit and danger, and very easy to distribute. And so in the sense that we don't really have to worry about a centralized state trying to control nanotechnology, there probably won't be a single point of focus for control. That also means that if there are control nanites in the environment, someone clever will develop anti-control nanites in the environment. At least we'd have to want to work to that kind of thing. I mean, again, perhaps the biggest, most important issue in nanotechnology is the issue of defense against nanotechnology.
Mm-hmm.
That really is almost a bigger part of the problem than anything of the benefits that we get.
All right. Not a lot of time. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Pesce. Hi.
Hi, this is Justin listening in Minneapolis on AM 1500.
Yes, sir, KSTP.
Yep. I have a question about how could you possibly power all these trillions of little nanites in a sustainable way?
It's a very good question. There are a lot of proposals on the table right now. Some of them involve using microwaves, ultraviolet light, sunlight, and infrared light. You can use the photoelectric effect on these devices. Now, if you have a nanite that's floating around inside your body, it might be metabolizing sugars that are in your body. It might be beaming microwaves at a very low level into your body to keep them activated. Now, one of the upsides of this sort of thing is it provides a way to turn them off. Because if you deprive them of whatever their power source is, you've effectively deprived them of their ability to function. But it's one of the issues that researchers are looking into right now when they're studying how to make these devices work.
And also, if they're electronically based, what would happen if you aimed extremely high-powered EMPs at them, or high-powered microwaves, or what if they got hit by a solar flare? Would that knock them out?
Yeah, it would probably knock them out in the same way that our computer chips these days can be knocked out by solar flares.
All right. Thank you very much. I never even considered that aspect of it. In other words, there might be things in the environment that would kill a nanotechnological project of some sort, deader than a doornail.
Absolutely. The smaller you get, the easier it is for them to break.
Huh. All right. Once again, your book is called Playful World. And your book is available all around the playful world right now, right?
Absolutely.
Bookstores and on Amazon.com and website and all the rest of it. We've got a link to your website up there right now. And your email address is mark@playful.com.
Playful World.
Playful World, I'm sorry, .com.
.com.
So easy. Well, you're going to get a lot of emails. Are you able to answer them?
I'll try.
Would you say you're looking forward to the development of this technology, or you are wary of the development of this technology, or both?
I would say I'm guardedly optimistic. I believe the basic principle of chaos theory is sensitive dependence on initial conditions. And I think that we need to make the best possible world for nanotechnology. We need to make the best possible awareness for the public, for the government, for the researchers. If we do that, we stand the best possible chance of navigating this incredible transition.
Well, it sure has been a pleasure having you on the program, and if you're up to it, we will definitely do it again, because we've hardly scratched the nanotechnological surface here, and so will you come back?
Absolutely. I've had a great time. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. You're very welcome. Good night, Mark. All right. Tomorrow night, Linda Moulton Howe will be here in the first hour. She was displaced, and she volunteered to be displaced. She's got a lot of very important information. But as you know, Richard Hoagland had also some incredibly current important information in tonight's first hour. So she will be here tomorrow night in the first hour. I'm Art Bell from the high desert, where finally the devil winds have let up a little bit. High pressure is settling in. A great big, or is it a little tiny, nanotechnological ta-ta.
In the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in all the world's time zones. And both of them are pretty dark that we talk to at this time of night. How you doing? I'm Art Bell, and this is the weekend version of Coast to Coast AM. As a little follow-up to last night's program, we're going to be very busy tonight, but Trenton, New Jersey, Associated Press, Alina Slow, documented as the world's oldest woman, died today at the nursing home where her daughter died 3 days earlier. She was 114 or 15, depending on to which, you know, which source you believe. Her daughter had died at the same nursing home a few days earlier. Her daughter was 90 years old. Now, try and imagine being old enough to watch your 90-year-old daughter die. Being old enough to watch your 90-year-old daughter die. Holy mackerel. Anyway, so much for longevity. Tonight we will examine the story of the claw. Actually, we're going to do many things, but the claw is going to be first. Dr. Roger Lear is here. Dr. Roger Lear, author of his book is Aliens and the Scalpel. It's an intriguing title, isn't it? And it's said to be one of the world's most important leaders that we're about to interview in physical evidence research involving the field of ufology. He and his surgical team have performed 9 surgeries on alleged alien abductees. This has resulted in the removal of 10 separate and distinct objects suspected of being alien implants. These objects have been scientifically investigated by some of the most prestigious laboratories in the world. Their findings have been baffling. Some comparisons have been made to meteorite samples. Dr. Lear anticipates performing yet more surgeries in the future and will investigate the physiological and biological aspects of the abduction phenomenon. He has also formed a nonprofit organization for this specific purpose called A&S Research, Inc. In a moment, Dr. Lear will relate for you the story of the claw. By the way, in the next hour, Richard C. Hoagland is here with some shocking information. Then we're going to have a discussion with Mike Heiser in the hour following that about ETs and religion. That's going to be very interesting. I plan to play the part of a right-wing religious fundamentalist fanatic, and we'll see how they do with me. In the meantime, we're about to hear the story of the claw, delivered serendipitously one day to Dr. Lear's front porch. In a large box, he opened it, and it came directly at him. He just barely got it off. No, that's not the story of the claw, but here comes the real story of the claw. Dr. Lear, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you again, Art.
Great to have you. We're going to have to treat this, though I know the Claw has been under investigation for a long time. Really, this is going to be more the story of how things are investigated the real way when something anomalous shows up. It doesn't happen frequently enough. You know, they go in drawers and closets and they're forgotten and they're never investigated properly. So let's tell the story of the Claw.
Well, Art, this is a non-implant case that we've been investigating for some years now. And as far as abduction cases go, it probably has more physical evidence than any case in the books that are on record. And that's why I got interested in it. And I don't mind to say the name because people will recognize it if they've been following so long. So this we're talking about the Gary Lowery case.
The Gary, well, okay, give us a brief overview of that case. What happened?
He's a gentleman with a family who was a fireman, and his job in the fire department was that of an arson investigator. So he was sort of a professional at collecting physical evidence in the first place.
Okay.
He and his family have been involved with the alien abduction phenomena for some years now, and during the course of this there's been a lot of physical evidence, things that go on around the house, which there's magnetic anomalies.
So in other words, they're victims of abduction themselves.
Correct.
What you're saying, all right.
That's correct. Involves him and the whole family. Now, to shorten the story so we can get basically to the point, one of the things that Gary was doing was trying to collect footprints. And he did this in a very simple manner. He took a towel, which was the same color as the rug on the floor, and he laminated a piece of heavy tin foil on the back side of the towel and then placed that down on the floor in front of the wall area where he saw these come through. And he successfully got some footprints, which he casted. So he got one set of prints. Why not get more?
That's right.
So he tried doing this for several times and was relatively unsuccessful. So whoever or whatever was stepping on the towel decided, you know, maybe they would step over it or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a few scratches and things, but no more prints. But one morning he woke up and looked at the towel, and he could see a dark object that was kind of hooked in the loops of the towel.
Right.
And so he called his wife in, who had seen him place the towel on the floor the night before,
mm-hmm.
and was aware of the fact that it was clean, there was nothing on it. In fact, she was the one that laundered the towel. So here we have two eyewitnesses to this thing that's caught up in the fibers of this towel. So we took a look at it, and it's an object that's maybe about 3/4 inch long,
mm-hmm.
and it's dark in color and sort of has a point that goes down at the end. So he looked at it, and he said, this looks like a claw.
A claw.
And got a hold of me. I said, I'd be very much interested in seeing this, so I made a trip up to Bakersfield and looked at the towel and looked at this thing, and by golly, it looked like a claw, and it felt like a claw.
Hmm.
So here's where it all began. I said, we got to find out, you know, what this thing is, because we may really have something here of scientific importance. So we sent it off, first of all, to the University of California in Berkeley, to the Department of Zoology,
mm-hmm.
and a professor there who was head of the department to look at it, and he couldn't identify it.
He didn't know what kind of claw it was.
He didn't know what it was. So we went back with a letter written and signed by him that said he couldn't find out what this is.
What about the basic, is it animal, vegetable, mineral? I mean, did they do any initial tests to try and find out whether it was biological at all?
Oh, yes. Because the next thing we did was we sent it to my very good friend and friend of Whitley Strieber, Bill Mallow, who passed away last year, at Southwest Laboratories. And again, I don't mind saying the name of the laboratory because Bill's gone and we'll never get in there again. So no sense hiding the laboratory anymore. It was Southwest Labs in San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
He looked at it, and he looked at it microscopically, and he had a couple of people look at it at the University of Texas, and he ran some tests on it. And in the first place, under the microscope, he found a vegetable layer on the outside of this thing.
A vegetable layer.
A vegetable layer. So he called me on the phone and said, told me what he found. And I said, well, you know, Bill, that may not be too unusual, because if it is a claw or a nail, one of the most common things is they become infected with fungus. So you would find a vegetable layer.
Yes.
So he thought that was sounded okay. And he went ahead and proceeded to do some more tests on the inner layers. And he found that it contained a proteinaceous substance which was very close to keratin. Now, keratin is what makes up our fingernails. So with that ammunition, we were pretty well convinced
that it was
the claw.
Yeah, it's a claw.
Now, it went from there to a primate zoologist, PhD, at the San Diego Zoo. We took it down there personally, and this kind lady looked at it and pondered over the books and got on the internet and looked at it under their microscope and probed it with a probe and couldn't identify it as any primate claw that she ever saw.
Okay. So now, by now, you're really starting to think you've got something on your hands.
Yep. Now, we could have started tooting horns at any time, including right at that. Hey, guys, I think we got a claw for an extraterrestrial. Ooh, boy. But we didn't do that because that's not the way I work. I try and get some scientific basis. So we knew what we had to do at that point was obviously to look at the DNA.
Right, of course.
So specimens were very carefully taken in the manner at which they should be taken, which wasn't done in the O.J. case, and we sent these sterile specimens to a very, let's say, world famous genetic researcher who I can't mention his name.
That's all right. Yeah,
so
that's
famous.
Fine.
And he started doing the DNA studies, and he was funding it himself at the beginning. As we got on to it, the reports that we started getting back were absolutely earth-shocking.
In what sense?
They came back as non-terrestrial DNA.
Non-terrestrial.
So we said, oh boy, we got a tiger by the tail.
But nevertheless, DNA, huh? In other words, recognizable.
Recognizable DNA chains, but these chains didn't match anything in the database. Not human, not primate, nothing. So we went on, and as we went on, we had to raise some more money. And if you don't mind me mentioning their names, Bob and Zoe Hieronymus were very, very responsible for getting us some further funding.
No, I don't mind at all.
Nice people.
So you raised more money.
So we raised more money and continued the research with which virtually went on for about 2 years, still getting reports of stuff that we couldn't match for any terrestrial animal. So we had to go further with this.
Yeah, I think by now anybody would have declared, hey, we've got something biological not from this Earth. I mean, once you had DNA would seem to be, and stand by, folks, because there's more to this, a pretty conclusive hunk of evidence. If you get DNA, but it's not human or not known DNA, you've got it, I would think, but maybe not.
Well, as I said, you know, the temptation was there to, you know, really toot the horn about this and to...
That's probably when I would have tooted.
Yeah. It was a great temptation, believe me. I mean, you know, I certainly believe in the scientific method and scientific approach, but when we get reams of paperwork and DNA analysis that comes back that tells you got something that's not from here, boy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to keep your mouth shut. Mm. Of course, the people that were involved kept saying, I think we should keep our mouths shut, because the eventuality here was to get an article written in a scientific peer-reviewed journal.
Sure.
And by doing so, this would have been a first for not only phenomenology, but certainly for the field of UFOs and particularly that of abduction.
Okay, so you lip-sealed.
So lip-sealed, and I stopped talking about this case on television, on radio, and traveling about the world.
Yeah, I remember when you began to shut up about it.
Yeah, and of course, you know, you get all the character assassination stuff that, you know, he's hiding something, he's burying something,
mm-hmm.
something he's not going to do. The usual
well, you
stuff.
Actually were.
Yeah, true. For the moment.
Yeah.
But certainly not forever.
Right.
So anyway, we had to do something to really push this through through, you know, organized science. And so I got my good friends at National Institute for Discovery Science involved again.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, they've produced some, you know, scientific investigation of this portion of phenomenology, and Bob Bigelow has become quite, you know, famous in the field for certainly putting up funds for these investigations. And of course, now he's branched out in other things with Bigelow Aerospace and so on.
Nevertheless, over the years, Bob Bigelow gets a lot of credit for, you know, being there with the money for the research, the real serious research when people needed it. Over the years, he's done a hell of a lot of that.
You bet. And for those out there that aren't familiar, you know, with the whole story, the stuff and the rumors and everything they've heard, I'm sure you'll agree, Art, that Bob has not only put up money for this stuff, but in many cases he's put up money and never taken credit for what he's done.
I'm very well aware of that, yes.
So as far as I'm concerned, you know, they've been very good, good friends to me, and they've pioneered some, you know, fantastic research. The Roper poles, of course, everybody knows, but there's a lot of investigation they don't know about. And of course, there's a lot of rumors that things go into a pit and it never comes out and so on. So that's far from the truth. As a matter of fact, if folks want to go up on your website or my website or the NIDS website, they'll see not only photos of this object we're talking about, but there's a complete giant DNA report of every facet that we went to. So, again, on with the story. They've got the claw now, the specimens, the DNA, all the data. We have meetings, a plan of attack is formulated, and we start getting some first confirmatory results. If you got something, and you got something that's this unusual, and believe me, it was unusual, what you want to do is to get somebody else to confirm it.
That's right.
So that's the way science works, and if you would stick with the science, I think we'd all be better off.
And so what happened?
So we got some confirmatory data. And then as this was going on, the original genetic researcher kept working on the object along with these outside sources and developing new techniques and looking at this and looking at this piece of DNA and on and on and on. Then we sent it out to a third laboratory, which was doing some more work and a different aspect of the DNA, and we were looking at more, you know, primate things, you know, what could this be closest to, and so on and so on. So as this is going on, I mean, we are getting real close now to getting this first article in a peer-reviewed scientific journal.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we had a big meeting in Las Vegas at NIDS, and it was an all-day meeting. And believe me, I'm not ashamed to say that three-quarters of the material presented at this meeting was way over my head. I'm not a geneticist,
mm-hmm.
and I don't have the background and expertise in this field.
Well,
so,
even when they go into courtrooms with genetic material, you mentioned the O.J. trial, you know, they have to talk in numbers and they have to make very simple charts for people to try and understand. And even then it goes right over the heads of a lot of the jurors. So it's tough.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, one point, I felt, privileged to be there and just to sit there and listen to this stuff.
Shaking your head every now and then like, oh, yeah, I got it.
Yeah, man. That's it. And they're talking about multi-toss tests and this test and that test.
Yeah. Well, all right, well, let's get to the bottom line, because I do have a lot of other stuff I want to ask you about. I mean, the bottom line here is...
Okay. So we got a plan formulated to what we were going to do is to get this results published in a small scientific journal that was peer-reviewed, and then we talked about the criticism that we were going to get, and we tried to obviate that and so on, one jump ahead. And so things were going in that direction. We left the meeting, and everybody was jazzed, and we thought we had the tiger by the tail on some, very strange DNA. So researcher number one, we'll call him, goes back to the lab, and while NIDS is in the process of writing the article for the journal, my original friend decides to look at the RNA.
Hold it right there, Doc. That's a good hook. Bottom of the hour. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back.
Now it begins.
Subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
It certainly is. In a moment, the claw makes its final scratch. Dr. Roger Lear is my guest, and we'll wind this up and move on to other aspects of abductions and things, little things left behind, if you'll just stay right there. Once again, into the night with Dr. Roger Lear. Doctor, welcome back. All right, the final scratch of the claw.
Yes, we can't leave everybody hanging like a Chad.
Like a Chad.
So, yes, we started looking at the RNA, and of course that's ribonucleic acid, which is there before the DNA.
Right. Hey, Doctor, do me a favor and back away from the phone just a little bit. Your phone has a sort of a... sound to it.
Okay.
There you go. Oh, that's much better.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so you looked at the RNA.
We're looking at the RNA, and suddenly we get a match in the GenBank, a database match.
And?
And it turns out to be in the family of Molluscum, a mollusk, a snail, a slug.
It was a slug.
It was a slug. Right, so a terrestrial slug.
Oh, boy. And so I'm sure you felt like you just got slugged.
Yeah, I sure did. But, boy, at that time, I was just so tickled to death that I didn't flap my lips.
Oh, yeah.
In the wind.
Oh, yes, indeed.
How would all involved look if we had published this article and someone would have come along with this?
You'd have looked like slugs.
You'd have looked like slugs.
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. There's the story of what somebody has to go through to investigate something of this possible magnitude. Not a story of one that came out to be extraterrestrial, but nevertheless, that's the kind of thing you've got to go through. So if you've got a little anomalous something, don't be afraid to get hold of somebody like Dr. Lear or the Bigelow Foundation or somebody who can do the right kind of research, because, baby, that's what it takes. Dr. Lear, you have removed implants from people who have been abducted and had things put in them. Are you convinced, Doctor? After all, who better to ask than someone who's taken them out? Are you convinced that there really are abductions and that things really are being implanted in people? That's a straight-out question.
Well, let's take part one. Am I convinced personally there is such a thing as an abduction? Yes, I am. I've been all over the world, and I've talked to people and many, many countries, and the things that they talk about here in the U.S. are the same as what they talk about in South America or in Israel or Czechoslovakia.
And by the way, you know, China, too. That's something not too well known, but the fact of the matter is, while China will not allow a lot of things to be investigated, for some reason, the communist Chinese are actively even encouraging and backing UFO investigation. It's kind of strange.
Yes, they've got the largest organization for the investigation of UFOs in the world.
Now, why would you think that would be, Doctor?
I don't know. It's strange. I mean, given their governmental system and so on.
Yes.
Along with many other things, have no answer for. And that's what I was going to say. If people come along, so-called experts in this field, and they claim to know the answers, put your fingers in your ears, flap your arms, and run just as fast as you can, because it's nonsense. No one has the answer. All you wind up with, Art, if you follow the science, just follow the science, you wind up with more questions. And back to the claw, if you don't mind me just a sec. Here's some of the questions. How did the slug get in the towel in Gary's closet?
And lose a claw.
Yeah. How did the slug get mummified to the state in which it was found? Now, we just found out recently, and I haven't even published this yet, that slugs in the Bakersfield area are no longer than a half an inch. This slug was almost 3/4 of an inch in its mummified state. And when we look at the DNA, again, follow the science, we got a 97% match to a slug from New Zealand.
New Zealand.
And a 94% match to a sea slug. How did either one of those get into Gary's
closet? Well, maybe whoever it was who had been conducting the abductions had a sense of humor. And you mentioned that it had recognized apparently the towel with the aluminum foil for the footprints, so maybe it just said to its little alien self, hey, let's have some fun. Let's drop one of these New Zealand slug claws.
Or was it something that was on somebody's foot and fell off? I know I discussed this with Whitley, and he verified the fact that a number of different physical evidence cases showed things that were mysteriously there from the sea.
Well, you've had probably more experience with physical evidence than almost any other investigator, save perhaps crop circle investigation. So of those items that you have removed from people, how many, what percentage of those, only 10, but what percentage are anomalous today?
Well, the total number of the surgeries was 10 to date.
Yes.
And the number of objects was 11.
11.
One of these objects turned out to be a very expensive piece of glass. not expensive from the manufacturing standpoint, from the standpoint of the research to find out exactly what it was.
Yeah.
But the other 10 have all had anomalous things, both metallurgically and biologically. The two most outstanding things are three. One is when you examine the individual prior to the time that they're removed, you found that these objects are emitting electromagnetic field of about 6 milligauss. Now that, as you know, Art, that's a pretty...
Yes, it is. It certainly is.
And once they're out, they emit nothing, so they're obviously unplugged. Then you go look at the biological anomalies. We find that there's no inflammatory response by the body.
Can I just stop you 1 second? The fact that the radiation ceases when it's removed from the body, would that indicate to you that it's drawing its power from the biological entities to which it's attached, or that it's just remotely, you know, shut off?
I would say that the power source has been disconnected. It's been unplugged, because one of the biological findings we find is that there's not only a lack of inflammatory response, but there's a large number of nerve cells which are not politically correct for the anatomical area that they're in.
So it's modified the nerve structure near it.
That's what it seems to be.
Huh.
And, of course, the other startling things, you know, here's somebody that comes and they allege an alien abduction scenario, and the stories are all great. They're extremely interesting. I love them, love to hear them, catalog them, write them, and so on. But to me, you know, the thing is the physical evidence aspect.
Sure, of course, yes.
So you look at the metallurgy, and, I mean, that information comes back to me from laboratories like New Mexico Tech, Los Alamos National Labs, and on and on and on, and they tell me, for example, they find iron, and the iron turns out to be amorphous iron, but yet the object is so magnetic, they can't understand how it could possibly be magnetic at all when the iron in the object has no molecular structure.
Doctor, is there anything in any and or all of the cases that would lead you toward a clue about function?
Function is entirely theoretical as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there's a number of popular theories. One that could be transponders for location, or modifiers of behavior, or they could be detection devices such as we use with astronauts. But I have another theory, and I think that they are perhaps at least some group of them are genetic detection devices to detect modification in our genetics. I believe, again, that going around the world, I think that the kids that have been born within the last 40, 50 years are not the same human beings.
You're not the first person to say that. Can you back that up with any science at all?
I know that it's possible. I was talking to Colin Kelleher at NIDS. He thinks that we could do a study to look at the old DNA versus new DNA.
Yes.
And possibly pinpoint it. All we need is the funds to do it. But, you know, there's a large amount of books that are coming out now. The Millennium Children. The Children.
I know. Oh, I know. Star Children. All
Star Children. The Indigo Children.
Right. Then let's try this angle. What do you think is the difference between these children and my generation? What's the difference?
Well, I can tell you exactly. You asked me if there's scientific proof. There's statistical scientific proof, because they've done a study on 17 functional growth characteristics. This has nothing to do with the child's mood or their IQ or anything else, or what they're wearing or what they ate. It's just, you know, what age did they stand? What age did they raise their head? Which age did they talk? And so on.
Yes.
And we find, looking at 17 functional growth characteristics, and in a 40-year period, 1947 to 1987, they've been accelerated from 16, that's 1/6, to 80%.
Wow.
You can't argue with that.
That is a big difference. Wow.
And how many mothers do you talk to that tell you, you know, their child has done this or said this, and they don't know where it could look at them?
So then, doctor, maybe all of these alien abductions and this interaction between aliens and humans, I mean, so many researchers think it's for genetic purposes, favoring them or favoring us, but genetic, because of the examination of reproductive organs, that kind of thing. The cows, all of that, the genetics there, all of this perhaps could be to our benefit in the sense that right before our very eyes, they're changing us.
Well, I'll tell you, I tend to lean in that direction, but I hate to use the word all, because, as you know, folks like David Jacobs, a famous, well-respected researcher.
Oh, I have a lot of respect for Dr. Jacobs.
Thinks that there's some hybrid program going on, and I tend to agree that maybe it's not the word all shouldn't be used, because maybe different strokes for different folks.
Well, what I respect about Dr. Jacobs is he's one of the very few people who has said, with regard to aliens, hey, wait a minute now, all this warm, fuzzy stuff. You know, they may not be our friends, and we don't really know, and you've got to admit, we don't really know what they're doing. And so I'd say it's even money on whether it's good for us or perhaps not so good for us.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, and it just goes back to what I said before. If any one of us claims to have the answers, say you better put your fingers in your ears and run, because we don't.
Mm-hmm. How many, this is just asking for a guess here, but how many people do you suppose are running around who are implanted, who, A, may not have the faintest idea themselves they've been implanted, and B, nobody else knows as well. In other words, how many are out there that we don't know about versus the ones that have come and complained?
Well, let's look at the few figures that we have from the Roper poll, for example,
okay.
In relation to the amount of abductees of the 2%. And we're talking about quite a few million people if we multiply this on a worldwide basis. And it would seem to me that in my experience, which is small and brief, that there's about 15% that might be have objects in them for some reason. And this kind of goes along. What do we do with our implanting lesser life forms?
Yes.
About 15%.
So you're suggesting you do believe that 15% of the totality of the population is implanted?
To the abductee.
Of those who have claimed abduction?
Right. Now, also another thing, you just hit on it a minute ago. If things go the way they're supposed to go, I don't think you're supposed to know you've been abducted.
I rather suspect not, except in perhaps rare cases. I don't think you're supposed to know you are either, and if they're really talented at creating a situation where you don't remember and you don't know, then most of them probably haven't been reported.
I think one of the things that's going on is, as we discussed with the kids, is an expansion of consciousness, and this can become a problem, because it can become a problem for the abductor. If one's consciousness is being expanded, then all of a sudden you're going to have a few leaked through memories of things that you may have not been aware of before.
If you were aware, doctor, that you had an implant yourself, would you remove it or would you leave it and see what happened?
Oh, I would have to give you a very biased answer on that, because, if someone asked me if, a craft landed and I was waved aboard, would I go? Of course I'd go. All fear would be outweighed by the scientific curiosity. Someone asked me probably if
I know, but your scientific curiosity in the case of an implant you knew you had in yourself could be... I guess there's two directions for that. On the one hand, you could take it out and try and examine it. On the other hand, you could leave it in and try and figure out what it was doing to you.
Oh, that's good. That's a good question, because, boy, that sticks it right home.
Yeah.
Again, scientific curiosity could go two ways. But I think I would leave it in, and if I could get the test done that I thought should be run on it, I would leave it in there for as long as I possibly could to get the most amount of knowledge out of it before it was ever removed.
Yes. Well, the one that stood the hair on the back of my neck straight up was when Whitley and the surgeon who did the work on Whitley were on the program, and the surgeon said straight to me, Art. I got in there, I got near it with a scalpel, and I watched it move within his ear. The implant moved by itself to a place where I couldn't get it without doing damage.
Well, Art, the last case I did was a case of a lady who had an object in the arm that when you touched it, it moved out of the way. And when we went to remove it, the surgeon that did it had to put a finger on either side to keep it in the surgical wound area.
Oh, my. Really?
And we got it.
And you got it?
And we got it.
And was it moving after you got it?
Nope.
No. So, I guess all of this is going to remain very mysterious and unsettling until we can... I don't know how we move forward in this area, how we learn anything, but we've got to. It's too interesting. Where do you go? That's, I guess, a good question. Where does your research go now?
Well, we've got to raise the necessary funds so that we can keep the fires of scientific research going in the manner that we did with the claw. The claw should be a really good example of how academic science can be applied to phenomenology, ufology, or any other field that you want to investigate.
Well, as you know, I was given a piece of material said to be from the Roswell crash, which we had investigated by Carnegie and others, and is indeed anomalous, not from this world, and I still have it. And it's a kind of an odd thing, because when I got it, I really thought very hard about what to do about it. And I can tell you that most people, doctor, are going to just put it away as an oddity, and they're never going to turn it over to anybody. If somebody's got something out there, and you can bet your bottom dollar they do, and they want to get hold of you to have you take a look-see at something or test something, how do they do that? How do they get hold of you?
Well, the easiest way is to go through my website, which is alienscalpel.com with one S.
Right. And by the way, your book, they might want to read, The Alien and the Scalpel, still out there. Still, I take it available on eBay or whatever.
Yeah, it should be able to get it. And if they can't, again, go through the website and we'd be happy to get them a copy.
So one way or the other, they can get it.
Sure, and then my new one out that has one great story in it, the anthology that we wrote called Chopped Liver.
Chopped Liver? Now, there's a title for a book, Chopped Liver, huh?
Chopped Liver.
All right. Well, as always, Dr. Lear, it's a pleasure having you here, and I want to thank you for all the work you do on behalf of those who want to know what the hell's going on out there. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mark.
Good night, Dr. Lear. It is a very odd world we live in, isn't it? All right, coming up, this is going to be really fun, I think. Richard C. Hoagland is coming on next. He's got some kind of breaking news for you on the face on Mars. And then we're going to move into another area, which will be the subject of one of Richard's conferences coming up shortly. And I think it's been needed for a very, very long time, and that is... what the world is going to do from the point of view of religion and all of that if they become obvious. How will we all handle it? That's what we're going to be talking about. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Call now to start your after dark.
Don't you love her as she's walking out the door? Like she did 1,000 times before. Don't you love her ways? Tell me what you say. We'll be right back.
from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 775-727-1222 or call the wildcard line at 775-727-1295. To talk with Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is indeed a brand new weekend version. How y'all doing? And by the way, we're here all of Saturday and all of Sunday night. And so if your radio station doesn't carry all of Saturday and all of Sunday night, call them up and say, hey, what's up? What are you doing in the middle of the night when you could be doing something much better? Right on the mark is Richard C. Hoagland, a former Space Science Museum curator. It's hard to picture him in that role. A former NASA consultant, and during the historic Apollo missions to the moon, was science advisor to Walter C. Cronkite, CBS News. The past 19 years, Hoagland has been leading an outside scientific team in a critically acclaimed independent analysis of possible intelligently designed artifacts on Mars and annoying legions of people. In the past 4 years, he and his team's investigators have been quietly extended to include over 30 years of previously hidden data from NASA. That's part of why he's annoyed people. NASA, the Soviet and Pentagon missions to the moon. Now, he's a remarkable man, and what I would suggest as a beginning point for all of us that are computer capable is that you immediately go to your computer for the conversation that's about to ensue and go to enterprisemission.com. There'll be a link certainly on the Coast to Coast AM website. Get to enterprisemission.com. And you're going to want to, and I know that everything's going to go berserk here, you're going to want to go to the page that shows, there's a link there that says the light finally dawns at Cydonia. And you're going to want to get that picture on your computer screen for what's coming. And it's coming next. And here is Richard C. Oakland. Yay, Richard.
You know, we got to stop meeting like this.
Yeah.
People it's are beginning
been
to
years
talk.
And years. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great.
Good.
And you?
I'm just fine.
There's a lilt in your voice that I have not heard in quite a while. You're like the old Dalmatian in a damn fire engine.
I wonder if my cheeks have a little rosy tint to me. Anyway, look, you've got something pretty big, in my opinion.
So you went and looked?
Oh, hell yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know what? I had Ramona in here just before showtime, and, you know, she's seen the face many times.
Excellent.
And she just took a real quick glance at it, and she said, what's that reflecting? You know, and that's total layman. Ramona's,
yep.
You know,
yep.
And she just, boom, hit it right on the head. And I said, yep, that's what it's going to be about. What
it's
the
like,
hell's reflecting? It's a
like
new,
the Robin test.
Yes, it's a way of the Robin test. Yes, it's a new picture of Cydonia. Now, I'm sure Richard will tell us how they got it and what they used and all the rest of it. But a new picture of Cydonia, it's at enterprisemission.com. You ought to be on the way there already. And you should be going to the area I said. There's a link down there. It says, the light finally dawns. On at Cydonia.
You like the title?
Yep. So when, what took it, what mode was the satellite in, from
okay.
What distance, and blah, blah?
Well, oddly enough, this was released. I mean, it was taken over a year ago.
Okay.
And it takes them that long to kind of release this these things.
Well, I know. They probably feel like they have to have it in their desk drawer for a period of time to age it properly.
Yeah, it was taken on the one-year anniversary, exactly on the one-year anniversary of the arrival of the Mars Odyssey spacecraft at Mars. And
yes.
These guys, remember, they're into dates and anniversaries.
So you say. Yeah.
Well, in their own published data, they took this on October 24, 2002, which was 1 year after they arrived. Exactly 1 year.
Right. They probably take it at 19.5 minutes after the hour in your honor or something, right? So anyway, the 1 year after the satellite
yep,
went up,
yep.
They take the photo.
Well, the thing that struck me was I was in Roswell the weekend that they actually released this image. They released it around July 4th.
Right.
And I had never gone to Roswell. I wanted to take Robin down there and see a few friends, you know, like Paul Davids was going to be there and Larry Landsman from Sci-Fi. And I'd never been part of the Roswell Circus. So while I'm there kind of taking a vacation, they released this picture. So I get back and I get caught up on email and someone sent me, you know, some links and said, take a look at this.
Mm-hmm.
And what was unusual, first of all, is that it was the first morning shot of Sidonia we've ever had.
And showing the with light on the eastern side.
On the eastern
right?
side okay. of the face and other structures.
All right. And so so you might explain to the audience, the sun actually on Mars at the moment this is taken really is not over the horizon.
That's
yet.
Right. Well, that's if you go and look at the logs that they're required by law to post, if you go to the ASU website, Arizona State University website, which is the university team actually running the camera on the Mars Odyssey spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
They have a website, which is linked through Enterprise, and you can go to the actual page. In the article that you have cited, we have extensive links to all the official information so that everybody can follow the bouncing ball. There's nothing here, no sleight of hand, no magic, no, you know, hidden stuff. We're laying out what they have given the American people and the world. So I went to their official website, and I'm looking at this picture, first dawn image of Sidonia, and the first thing that rings a bell is when I look at the very bottom of the data block, it says Sidonia face at night.
Right.
How the heck can you take a picture with this camera at night? They have trouble taking pictures when the sun is fairly low above the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
How the heck could they take it at night? So I looked a little closer, and in the data block, there's a whole bunch of angles listed. You know, the subspacecraft point, where the sun is, you know, the angle that the spacecraft is rolled to the ground, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one little line that says phase angle, which is the angle between the sun, the surface, and the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Which read 90.304 degrees.
So the sun then, that would put the sun then just below the horizon.
Below the horizon. Mm-hmm. 0.3 of a degree below the horizon.
All right, so then what in the hell is the story with this picture? I mean, obviously the entire eastern side of the face is lit up like it's made out of damned aluminum foil. I mean, it's impossible. Or not, I guess. Has anybody toyed with this photograph in any way, or what way?
This is from what's called the official archive. You know, there's a whole procedure of putting things into the planetary data system, and when things pop up on these websites, we're not supposed to believe the PR versions.
You're telling me this hasn't been toyed with?
No. This is exactly as they have given it to us.
You've got to be kidding.
And there are five bands represented. From
yeah.
the near-infrared
right.
through the violet.
All right.
You pick three of them. You put red, green, and blue filters on them, in essence.
Yes.
And you make yourself a pretty picture. And unlike the broadband filters in CCD television cameras or, you know, film,
mm-hmm.
these are very narrow-band filters. They're one micron wide, more or less. So they're basically scientifically isolating the way the light is interacting with the ground.
All right. Well, here's
much more precisely than a normal color picture.
Here's what's hitting me, and I could be wrong about this, but I think what we're seeing is the areas that we previously regarded as those that were damaged.
Yes.
Damaged, right? In other words,
well, no,
the face.
Well, no, that was the general consensus. Remember?
Well, I mean, just kind of a general consensus. If you imagine the face to be whole
yep.
and complete, then you would look at the areas that we're now looking at as kind of damaged areas, who knows, meteorites, whatever it is that did damage to the face originally, if you buy the fact that it was a full face at one time. These were then the damaged areas.
Well, all right. When the 2001 image came out a couple of years ago, the famous full face image,
right.
you and I had such... By the way, Art, you know, I've been listening to you for years. I have known you for even more years. I'm about the only guy that you really argue with. Normally, your
guests... That's not true.
No, come on.
That's not true.
You give a lot of your guests a chance to just lay out their story. But you and I, either consciously or unconsciously, have decided that it's much more interesting if we really confront those things we don't agree with.
Maybe it's just that you're fun to argue with.
Maybe that's true, too. And likewise, back when that first full-face image was released in 2001, you took one look at it and told me to go into storm windows.
Yeah, basically, I said it's a cat box. It's got about as much interest as my cat box on a full day, and that was exactly correct. Now, you did not see
what we saw and a lot of other people saw.
Yeah, I know.
Which is that, no, it's not symmetrical. But remember, back at the UN 11, 12 years ago now, I said it was not symmetrical. I said there were two different species represented from the western to the eastern half. And 99.98% of the other people looking at Cydonia seriously, people like Ben Flandern and a whole bunch of others, they have been, Carlotto comes to mind, they had been expecting a symmetrical or close to symmetrical representation, and I think that's what you expected too. When it did not look symmetrical or anything close to it, you guys threw your hands up and said, oh my God.
Yeah.
Now, you threw it up in one way, they threw it up in another way. They had the damaged side, preserved side hypothesis, and everybody thought that the eastern side, the side on the right, was the damaged side. We said in papers we published on Enterprise then that, no, guys, you got it exactly backward. It's the western side, the hominid side, the side toward the city, toward the pyramids, which is the damaged side, and it's the eastern side which has been protected and has preserved the original casing, whatever that was. Now we fast forward the film to July of this year. Odyssey takes a picture precisely at the one moment of day art where you can decide the issue, and they take it not just in one color, they give it to us in five colors. And if you look at